everyone, and welcome back once again to the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. We have the full crew here with me once again. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Happy pre-Gamescom slash European E3 podcast
edition. What is this E3?
It was a relic of the past. Back in the day.
Back in my day.
We have Adam Vitale. You heard him just now. We have James Glazio.
Don't you mean European Key 3?
There you go. And Chaman Wu.
How's it going?
So yeah, Josh kind of teed it up. We're kind of getting into a pretty busy time of the year. Like, we have the one little respite in July and August, and then next week is Gamescom, and of course that includes, as suggested by the early commentary, the Gamescom opening night thing hosted by Keighley, and then of course Gamescom itself. Some publishers themselves might try to align trailer announcements or release dates with Gamescom, so that's all next week. The week after that, we've got PAX West, then a little bit of a break, then the week after that, we've got TGS, and then we get into like the fall release, holiday, October, November, early December schedule. So it only goes fast from here. And probably like the first big game to talk about for like the back half of the year in terms of the RPG space we'll be talking about today. The reviews just went up a couple days ago at the time of recording. And that's what we're going to start out with. And that is Black Myth Wukong. This is a debut project from Game Science. It had like a big Unreal Engine 5 reveal trailer a few years ago. It was supposed to be kind of a graphical showcase for the new engine. It was the debut project for the studio. They kind of announced a release date pretty early, and I swore that it was going to be delayed, but it never was. So it got released. We have a review up on the site. It was written by Junior, one of our site contributors. He's not on the podcast, but Josh was also able to play back Black Myth Wukong. So we'll speak to Josh as kind of like our podcast representative of covering that game. So that's what we're going to start out with, and then we'll go into some fall release dates, some new announcements, and the usual kind of news rundown at the end here. But we'll start out with Black Myth Wukong, and we'll hand it over to Josh.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is like the first project that Game Science has done. I didn't actually look into it. It might have been like one other smaller thing they did. But there's definitely like their big project that people have been paying attention to ever since. It's really, really like visually jaw-dropping trailer that dropped like around 2020. It was that, that whole cinematic trailer of like the bug, like a close up of the bug with all these details, and then the monkey.
You are correct. They made Art of War Red Tides in 2016. I don't know what it's in early access still on Steam, free to play. But it's there. So okay, it's their second title.
And Black Myth Wukong is it's definitely like inspired by Souls likes. It has that whole design of like, hey, you have these shrines you go up to and these levels, which are ostensibly bonfires. When you rest at them, they'll respawn like minor enemies. And there's been a lot of attention of like, this will be. I'm not exactly sure. Like, people really like amazed by that trailer, and then like I guess it's just been had this like steady momentum and awareness over the years as they've shown of more bits and pieces of the trailer. But the final result is a game that has like some really truly visually stunning moments and scenery in it. The gameplay system is solid enough, but a lot of its game design decisions, especially some of its like boss battles, are not great. Like it's kind of like it runs into that problem where the hitbox of your weapon, it kind of sucks. So there'll be times like during bosses where they might be like in a phase where like you can't hit them or you can't just barely reach them. And there's not enough visual clarity or visual feedback to really tell you from the get-go, like if you're actually making contact with them. Like the way that I did it, like, as I played more of the game, was like, oh, there's a damage number popping up. You can turn that on the options. And it's like, okay, I know my attack.
I saw a review for this game, just a headline. I think it was VGC, and their kind of declaration was, Black Myth Wukong is a boss rush. if a somewhat boring one. So does this game like have a really high emphasis on like boss battles?
I wouldn't call it a boss rush. There's definitely, okay, so here's how it's laid out, like the structure of the game. There's several chapters for people who don't want to know the final chapter count. I won't reveal that. In each of these chapters, you're sent to this like the stage, this level. It's not as short as like a something from Neo. It's much more expensive. It's like you'll be getting through each chapter. It'll take like multiple hours to get through each chapter because they're from different regions, show different biomes. And it's a fairly linear level that you're traveling like pretty much in a straight line. But the way to get to like the final boss of each chapter is there's some branching paths that some of them lead to the same point. Some of them, well, very few of them lead to dead ends that might have treasure. And some of them lead to like optional areas that has optional bosses. But they're still like trash mobs or smaller enemy mobs that you need to either get through, whether you're beating them up or you run through them to like get to like a shrine bonfire. And then usually these shrines or bonfires are not that far away from like a nearby boss. But it's not like boss after boss after boss. There's definitely a handful of bosses. Like I'd say you're looking at maybe like roughly 9 to 12-ish bosses, just a rough count before you get to like the end boss of a chapter. And there's like a mix of like mandatory and smaller optional bosses. Sometimes it'll be like wandering mini bosses that like you see out in the world or in the stage, and then you run out to them like, hey, they happen to have a bigger health bar, so you know it's like a mini boss, and so forth. But I wouldn't call it a boss rush. No, I mean unless you're playing the game as in like you're just running through all like the smaller mobs just to like get to a boss, and then you're doing that, and then once again after you beat that boss, maybe you're just like running through everything to get to the next boss, which is like, I guess you could call it a boss rush in that definition, but I wouldn't call it a boss rush. It's much more just a traditional kind of like action RPG type of game that does have a bit of Souls-like mechanics, but the cadence of combat isn't as deliberate or as slow-paced as like the Dark Souls series or so forth. I would call it more in line with like the aggressiveness of like Bloodborne and a little bit of Neo. Like you're more proactive in combat. You're encouraged to be aggressive and to be on the offense against enemies and bosses, more so than like in Dark Souls, where you're kind of more picking your strikes in a more deliberate manner.
I was trying to think of like the Souls like that I've played, which ones are the most like boss focused versus like map focused or like level focused. Like I guess the Dark Souls series itself, 1, 2, and 3, have a pretty good balance. I think maybe like Wolong and Neo are a little bit more boss focused, but even then, some of those levels in those games, they're a little bit more bite-sized. They're not an hour long. They're like 20-25 minutes, but they're pretty expansive.
Yeah,
I don't know, it just seems like most games in that genre, I feel, that I've played anyway, have hit a good balance. What you're describing doesn't seem too far off from that.
Yeah, but the thing that's kind of, before I get to like describing the battle system, the thing I will mention right from the get-go is like wandering through these like levels, like these stages, since they're so big and like they take multiple hours, like it's kind of a little bit frustrating. And that frustration builds up over time of like just the game having no map whatsoever. There's no mini map. There's no overhead map. There's no sort of map system at all whatsoever. The only thing that is sort of like guidance in this game is like when you're coming up to a nearby shrine that you haven't activated yet, there'll be like little Monster Hunter World scout flies that activate when you're coming up near it, and it's kind of pointing you to like, hey, there's a shrine nearby this way, you know. But it's not something that did like you can press a button to activate. It's just something that happens on its own when you're like in the vicinity and so forth. So it's more baffling because there's, as you're wandering through these levels, they have the illusion of being bigger than they are at times. When you'll just like wander through this like snowy forest, for example, and all of a sudden you'll hit an invisible wall because you saw a clearing out in the distance. Like, oh, I wonder if there's a boss there. There's something cool there. It's like, oh no, you just can't go this way. Please pick another route, basically, because you hit an invisible wall. If it's not an invisible wall, then it's just geometry that's just blocking your way that you can't get over. you do have a jump button, but this jump button is for the most part not really that useful in general traversal, because it's a very small jump and you can hop over like some small ledges, but it's never really used to like, hey, I access this part of the map by jumping over like a small like tree stump, for example. Usually, more often than not, it'll just be geometry that you can't get through. You press jump by it, you just can't climb it or anything. So you're kind of left to your own device. It's like, okay, well, this way doesn't work, so I guess I'll just push on this way and hold forward and just come what may. And like I said earlier, some of these levels have a lot of multiple paths that lead to optional areas and optional bosses. So it's hard to determine whether you're like going on an optional route, or you're going on the quote unquote main route.
Yeah, so
or
I remember
going on an alternate path to get to that's part of the main route, or that leads back to the main route. It's just it's very enigmatic in that sense.
So I remember when you and Junior, our reviewer, were talking about this game and talking about no map and being like level based. My first thought was, wait, like games like Neo are level based and don't have a map. Like, that wasn't really a problem there, but these are significantly more expansive than Neo.
Yes.
And like,
yeah, I mean, those Neo levels like take about maybe half an hour max to like
and
get through a map and boss.
And also, Neo levels are oftentimes, I think, you know, relatively constrained, like in like a
yeah.
city-ish area, and it's pretty, even if there is no map, pretty well organized in terms of like you can see where your paths are and you can
right.
see like where the like, boundary is. But
think about the Neo level design of like it. Yeah, they make it very clear to you of where you can and can't go. Like, say, like you're going by a burning village. Oh, you can't go that way because you're like a part of a house that's burned down. And that, yeah, pretty much, you can't go that way. And you can tell right away. Oh, I can't go this way. While in Wulong, it just sometimes it just doesn't have that, and it's just like it's just an invisible wall, and you're like, oh,
okay. Well, I'm kind of same vein as Adam. I was thinking when I just read that, like Dark Souls doesn't have a map, just like, you know, straight up. But it kind of goes for the unstated craft of making the map guide the player in a way that is intuitive. Like, are they going to be saying I need a map to navigate this or not? If your place is well designed, then maybe no. But if you're relying on invisible walls to that extent, or there's a place that looks like it should be explorable but that just isn't, then you end up saying, well, where's my map? I don't know where I can go, can and can't go.
Yeah, I just think having like just like a basic map would help a lot of like this my kind of not beef with the game, but it's just like there's some irritating elements in the game that's like that it feels like there was like simple solutions to this, and it just doesn't exist in it. So that's kind of a weird design decision. It feels deliberate also. There's a later chapter in the game that having no map is especially frustrating, because it's a way more wide open zone than previous areas, and you kind of get a traversal tool in that chapter that lets you more easily explore this super super wide open area, but just having no map in it just it kind of makes those problems even more evident in it. Junior goes a little bit into it but in the last part of his review, but I won't mention it in here, just because, you know, anyone who wants to get into it go into it blind not knowing, I'll just leave it at that.
How challenging did you find the game? Because some reviews said it was very hard. Some of them I know compared it to Shadow of the Erdtree. Some people said it was very forgiving and easy. And I know everyone has different skill levels, or they might have been trying to play the game in a way that was more or less rewarded by the game. Like, how did you find it in terms of difficulty?
Okay, so let me explain the combat system first before
okay,
I tackle sense. That. Yeah. So this game has a light and heavy attack button. It has like your dodge button. And the only weapon type that you have is this bow staff that you can craft better weapons using mats that you obtain throughout the game to make a better staff with higher stats and has a different visual appearance. Same thing with armor. As you progress the game, you can craft better armor, better defensive stats. It has different visual appearance. And also, for a lot of the armor that you craft, there'll be set bonuses. So, like, you know, just like in any other game, if you equip two or four of an armor set, it'll have different effects based on how much of that armor set that you wear. So that's cool. For the actual combat cadence itself, as you're attacking with your light attacks, you build up this resource called focus. Initially, you can only stack one focus, and then as you are unlocking more of the skill tree and using skill points for your three different stances that I'll get into in a bit, you'll unlock more focus points. The main benefit of having focus points is that it lets you do one of two things. One, it lets you use heavy attack finishers after your at any time during your combo string. So, like, you do, let's say, light attack, light attack, and then heavy attack. That'll consume one heavy attack, and then you can just consume another focus point for like a second heavy attack finisher follow up. That's like really, really powerful. And that's kind of the main point of the focus points. Another way you can use focus points is like you can consume them before without doing a light attack and just like charging up like a charged heavy attack. And then the more focus points you put into it, the more powerful it'll be. And then there'll be like the different bonuses like you unlock throughout the skill tree to enhance these effects. Like, for example, like the second hit of like your light attack will gain more focus. That's gonna be like a skill tree thing. Or one that I really took advantage of is like in the starting stance, the smash stance. Once you go to like a transition from like a light attack to a heavy attack, during this phase, there will be like some invincibility just frames in between that, so it'll nullify any incoming attack as you're initiating your first heavy attack, and so forth. So you can kind of craft like your own sense of playstyle and game build out of it. There's two other stances that you can unlock as you're leveling up. It's the pillar stance and the thrust stance. And the pillar stance it has an interesting style where, like, if you charge up like the heavy attack in it, like your character, who's called the Destined One, it's kind of like this nameless monkey going on a quest to go find the relics of Wukong. They'll have the charge attack of the pillar stance will have it climb the pole, so you're actually gaining elevation. And then when you let go of the button, it'll like smash down the bow staff once it reaches like the peak of it. So there's a way to kind of just immediately get some elevation for some to evade some moves from enemies. The thrust stance is you're kind of using the your bow staff more like a spear, and if you charge up your attack there, the more you charge up your bow staff with the thrust stance, the more it'll extend out to hit enemies. So it's kind of like a long poke, and then it's kind of like a more defensive stance as well when you're using it. When you're going to like your heavy attack string, it'll actually like back away to gain some distance while you're poking the enemy with it. And you can switch between any of these three stances on the fly during combat with the D-pad directions. So there are some interesting ways you can mix up, like, you know, your gameplay style and the way that you're strategizing between, like, how to react to boss phases, boss patterns, boss behaviors, because of the way that each of these stances work. But combat is fairly straightforward. Like, aside from the light and heavy attack strings and the focus points and all that, you have magic spells that you unlock along the way. You have a spell that can immobilize enemies for a brief moment, so like it actually freeze them. You have one that'll it's kind of like called Cloud Step, where it allows you to kind of do a dash, and then after that dash you're cloaked, so it kind of deploys like a little decoy when out of that. So you can get behind enemies as they're focused on your decoy. And then there's one you unlock early on after you beat like an optional boss that's kind of... It's obvious to go to that place and beat this. So after an early optional boss, you'll gain the option to transform. And one of your magical spells actually allows you to like transform into like this general like fire dude. for a brief amount of time, and you can actually use his moveset. As said, you're kind of gaining resources to do like big like heavy attacks that do a lot of damage before you untransform back. You also have another spell that like allows you to summon a lot of clones, so you know you can kind of just amplify your damage by having multiple clones like fight with you, and so forth. And there's also a spirit system where it's a separate transformation system where some enemies are kind of have like this blue flame around them, and you can like absorb their spirit after you beat them. They're kind of like harder versions of normal enemies. And so once you absorb their spirit, you can equip their spirit. So you can like transform into them very briefly for like an attack. So one of like the mini bosses that you beat early on that you get a spirit of, like you press L2 and R2 at the same time, you'll transform into that for like maybe 2 to 3 seconds max. It'll do a headbutt attack, do a lot of damage, then you'll transform back. And then you have to gather resources again to transform back. It usually it takes a while for that to come up. So you do have like a fair bit of options. There's still some magical spells that I didn't detail here that you unlock. But there's a lot of different ways you can go about the game, how you tackle it. But to your point of like, okay, so how does this actually reflect in combat? Like what's the difficulty level of bosses? I think 80% of the bosses are fine. Like that, like I think they're fairly okay. Like they didn't. If I died to them once, like usually the second or third try, I would be okay. But most of them, I was able to like deal with just fine. There's definitely some really, really poorly designed bosses, I would say. For example, one of the bosses early on in the game is like this desert sage. And the design philosophy of this fight is we're going to make this fight harder by making it more difficult to see this boss as the boss battle goes on. So after you kind of deal some damage to it, it goes into a phase where it retreats into the background, and it projects mirage illusions of itself that you have to dodge because you can't hit them until the boss shows up again, so you can hit it. You're like, okay, that's whatever. And then as the boss fight goes on, like the surrounding sandstorm makes the screen more like more dirty, more like it's getting harder to see where the boss is. And then like around the 30% mark, it'll summon like a persistent tornado that follows you around slowly. But if it hits you, it'll do a little bit of damage. And more importantly, it interrupts whatever you're doing no matter what. It's like you're blown into it and you have to wait for like 3 to 4 seconds before you're able to play the game again because you ran into it. And the boss model can't stand in it. So if it's within this tornado, you can't engage with it unless like you do like a thrust dance. But you're risking staying stationary for a certain amount of time for your thrust stance to like hit the enemy.
And so I'm thinking, to play devil's advocate, you're saying this is a poorly designed boss because you sort of lose visibility or control. And I'm trying to think to myself just broadly, like, when is that well-designed and when is it poorly designed? Because I feel like bosses that, you know, might have like some sort of like screen splatter effect that are intentionally meant to get in your way, those exist, but usually it's almost like a penalty for like, whoa, you didn't dodge this attack that you could have dodged, and because you got hit by it, you might have ink on the screen or blood or something that.
Well, that's not even part of like I didn't get to the part where like that's like kind of the badly designed part of it.
Well, you're talking about like the sandstorm being being able to see.
So but the sandstorm part is like during like the latter like several parts of that fight, like especially at the latter part of that fight, it's always hard to like describe these, and like it's like you have to see it for yourself, right?
Right.
But like the boss can retreat into like these zones, and like your character model can't even reach them, like your attacks can't even reach them. They can just kind of retreat arbitrarily into like a safe zone and like attack you, and you're basically relying on like almost sound cues of incoming attacks to dodge them, and so forth. So it's just like one of those things that like it doesn't really have like a clear phase transition of like the when this like phase will start turning up. That's like it'll just start doing it arbitrarily as the latter parts of the fight go on. And for me, it's just like whenever a boss It's like, that's obviously more of like an endurance test boss of like, hey, if you're able to save your resources properly, you'll be able to fight, you know, this boss on a more equal ground at the last stretch of this fight. It just doesn't really appeal to me when the design philosophy of a boss, especially in that case, is like, I'll make it harder for you to see, but also at any time I can just like retreat back into this zone that I'm safe at, and you can't hurt me. Plus, I'll have these tornadoes following you. Plus, when I get back into the arena, my boss model might just so happen to be in one of the tornadoes, so you can't directly approach me immediately. You'll have to kind of wait your turn. And it's like, is it impossible? No, it's not impossible. But is it like a frustrating way to kind of go about your boss at that sense? It's like, for me, of course it's going to be frustrating because, like, you're kind of extending the fight by making the player wait just, you know, when they've already waited so many times at other parts of that fight. Like, I think this game loves to do that with a lot of its bosses, where at some point in the fight, there'll be, like, a point where the boss model will go up into the air and they'll do so, and they're so high up in the air that you are obviously cannot hit them at all. There's nothing in your arsenal, there's no options available to you in which you could hit them. You have to kind of wait out this 25 to 30 second long attack pattern to play out until they go back to like the ground level so you can hit them again. And because anytime like a boss has elevation, this game really, really suffers from it. It feels bad to fight anytime that a boss is like floating or has elevation. Like another example is like an ice dragon, a boss fight against an ice dragon. Obviously, it's a flying dragon. It hardly ever touches the ground. It's usually floating.
Like a Chinese style dragon, really long, snake like. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And so, and because whether it's the boss's hitbox or your weapon hitbox, something about them is not coinciding. Maybe about 50 to 60% of like your normal attack string. When you're up close and hitting those attacks, maybe 50 to 60% of those will just not connect because of the way the hitboxes are not interacting with one another, because that boss is slightly more elevated than most of the other bosses, so that makes that problem more prevalent. On top of, once again, just having a phase where it just floats up in the air and you're, you know, dodging like lightning strikes or something for, you know, 20 to 30 seconds before you're like, okay, I can play the game again. And it loves to reuse this type of mechanic in a lot of its boss fights. And you're just like, all right, well, I mean, that's the game for you. You know?
So I just have a question. Like, so are these like those Chinese dragons that are, I don't know, let's think about Dragon Ball for a second, like the Shenlong, where it's like kind of like swirly, you know what I'm saying? It's like going back and forth. Like, would that affect your like camera lock on? Like,
oh, your camera's dog. You're like, for some, like, usually the camera is okay at tracking normal enemies. It's totally fine. For a good chunk of bosses, it's fine. Like, because what the camera will do is kind of like that Sekiro lock-on, where it'll, your lock-on reticle is at the center of the model, so you're always kind of locked into like what the enemy model is doing, because you're at the center mass of it, so you have a good view of like what it's doing at any given time. But for that, some bosses like that ice dragon, for example, the lock-on reticle is at its head. Even though the like other parts of its body can be hit, it's locked onto its head, and of course is like just moving around wildly, so your camera is just spazzing out all over the place during
that. I'm remembering Elden Ring fighting those like ulcerating tree spirits that just like writhe and wiggle and jump. I'm like, god damn it,
stop. Yeah, it's just like absolute dog shit. So it's like, okay, great. that's awesome, you know. So there'll just be some parts of the camera, like, you know, there'll be camera problems in this game that people will suffer. Like, you know, for bigger model bosses, when you're getting up close to them, like the camera doesn't zoom out. You know, you're kind of stuck with like this closed-in camera. The boss model might be blocking you, but you're like, well, I mean, this is what they decided to go with. I mean, there's the cards that I was dealt with, so I kind of just have to muscle my way through it. So there's definitely some fight design stuff that feel almost outdated. It feels like, you know, modern action games have largely solved this, I would think, and Wukong, it just feels like something that's like more antiquated in that respect, where it just like they didn't like think about it, I guess, of like, oh, it's totally fine when like a boss model blocks your camera and people are cool with that, right? It's like, yes, I love when I love not knowing what my character is doing because a model is blocking it. It's awesome. You know, so there's stuff like that. But there's good parts about the game in the sense that like they're really good at like visual spectacle and choreography. Like there'll be like multi-phase boss battles that like kind of they put you in different situations in that battle, and then like for some of them they do a good job of like, hey, if you died at like the second phase of this boss and you respawn, you don't have to do the first phase of the boss again. You can restart from the second phase like immediately. That's all for not all of them, but for a handful of them, which is nice.
Do they have some weird wording like F7 retry from this part or something like that?
The checkpointing is hit and miss. Sometimes it's like it's fine, like it's like maybe a 10 to 15 second walk to the boss to restart it. Fine.
To walk to the area or just automatically spawn there.
So sometimes it's just like it takes you like 30 to 45 seconds to get to the boss, and it's like it's a grueling fucking trip on the way back because you're just like kind of just wasting time running through like a very open wide zone just to get to the boss. Like the Ice Dragon one, you have to walk through this path through like a forest to get to the clearing, and then once you get to like the actual like lake arena for this boss, the boss is still like 10 miles out from you, because that's at the other side of this really, really huge lake arena. So you're still taking another 10 to 15 seconds to actually run into the range of which you can actually start engaging the fight for that boss. And like it's kind of dog shit, you know, just doing that.
I remember I was reading a Reddit post or a forum post about someone playing the original Dark Souls or the remastered version in 2023 or 2024. And that game, like, they are not generous with, like, the bonfire placement outside of boss rooms. And then I remember when Dark Souls 2 came out, it was a lot more almost arcadey feeling, where a lot of the paths are more separate. They didn't intertwine very well. But then one thing that it did do is that it kind of, I don't know if standardized is the right word, but it pretty frequently put a bonfire or save point right outside the boss room, or, like, within a room of the boss room. And I feel like The Souls likes that I've played, Elden Ring, Nioh, Wolong, those, like, it seems pretty common and almost like expected that there was a checkpoint at least outside the boss room. So the fact that Wolong doesn't all, sorry, not Wolong, Wukong, we're gonna run into that.
I know, they're so bad at that.
doesn't do that. I'm like, well, Dark Souls didn't do that, but also like Dark Souls 2 and 3 did, and every other game has been, like, it's one of those things where it's like, if you're struggling with the boss, why punish the player and have them like just run through, you know, 20, 25 seconds sprinting through enemy mobs, just trying to ignore them, just to retry where you're actually needing to retry? At that point, what are you gaining from that?
Yeah. So like I said, this game feels outdated in a lot of ways in that aspect. Maybe some people do enjoy that walk of shame back to the boss. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's once again, it's like, okay, it's not unbearable, but it's like it just feels bad. Other things I like about this game, you can freely respec like your the talent points or the spark points that you get from leveling up. Whenever you level up, you get a spark, and then you can put it into like, you know, there's various trees. Like, you know, you have your basic like stat tree where you can like upgrade like your health, mana, stamina. Recovery rate, critical hit chance. There's one to like upgrade like your light attack string. There's separate trees for like every single like spell you have, like for the cloud step or the immobilize. There's one like I mentioned earlier for each of your three pillar or three stances for your staff. So there's a lot of like different decisions that you know you can make when you're building out your character. And at any time, like at a shrine, you can like respec all the spark points if you want to try out another thing. The one thing, like, it's interesting because it's very, you would think that this game's like, oh wow, this game's like very, very like customizable in this aspect. Surely it permeates throughout like the DNA of this game. And then there's like stuff like the relic system, that you get a relic for every time you finish a chapter. in the game. And it's like, it gives you these three selectable like bonuses for it. So for example, let me go pull up the sheet that I have. So for example, like the at the end of chapter one, you get this relic. You have three options, whether you want to increase your focus, increase the amount of focus you gain after like a certain amount of light attack hits, or you can increase the attack when you hit something out of your cloud step. That's called an unveiling strike. If you hit something out of that, the cooldown of that spell is reduced, or you can increase your critical hit damage. You can only pick one of these bonuses from that relic, and it's a permanent decision. There's no way to respect that, as far as me and Junior, the reviewer, are concerned, because like there's nothing in the game that like we never got anything that like lets us gives us the ability to do that. We don't know if it's like some hidden optional thing that like we didn't make the right turn at the right level down the optional path to fight this optional boss that might have given us the item to do that. As far as we know, that this the way you can't respect like these decisions when you get a relic, you know, those are permanent, and we never got the option to redo any of those decisions when we beat the game. So it's one of those like key decisions. It's like, oh, if you made this decision, you better hope that's like it's gonna be good for your whatever your final build is gonna be, your preferred playstyle, because some of these are pretty specific about the bonuses that they give, and if you spec into that and you no longer want to do that, then like you've wasted sort of like this bonus that you got for this relic, because you decided to spec into that and you don't feel it. You're not feeling it.
This sort of design is always tricky, because you have to be very careful with this sort of design, because you don't want the player to have like the power of foresight to know what's going to be useful later or not. So
yeah,
and like you're just sort of blindly guessing. This bonus will be worth it, and maybe it won't be. But you just
this reminded me of Flintlock with the weapon upgrades that you talked about. It's not quite the same, but it's similar. Where it's like you only can upgrade so much, and you don't know what you're intending to use in 15-20 hours, so you're just kind of stuck.
Yeah. So there's weird stuff about that. Even there's even some bonuses that contradict each other. Like one of the bonuses that I described to you refers to like using like the attack you do out of cloud step, and then in the next relic there's one that enhances some part of like the defense like spell that you get that allows you to turn into stone and deflect that attack. But both the cloud step and the stone spell occupy the same slots. You can only have either or of those spells, so if you chose both of those bonuses on those relics, you automatically give up one of those bonuses by just, you know, because they both occupy the same slot and you can't have them both on you at the same time.
So what you're saying is there's a wrong way to level up.
Yeah, there is a wrong way to level up. Absolutely, because some of those are just contradictory bonuses that you can choose. So it's kind of like a weird decision, once again.
I guess to be clear, this isn't the level up. This is like the level bonus stuff. Okay, yeah, the level up. Yeah, you can respec.
Yeah, yes, it's not the level. Yeah, what I'm describing once again is the relics that you get after you complete each chapter. You can hold off on making that decision for however long you want. But let's say like someone is like going to this the first time. You know, they don't know there's a permanent decision. Like everyone else going to this game like blind. You know, they're just like, oh, I'll just pick this one. This looks cool. Then they realize, oh shit, I can't like redo this. This is the one part of the game I can't redo. Everything else, it feels like I can redo, you know? So it's like, once again, this is like weird. another thing I really... Okay, so the story of this game is very odd. I won't go into spoilers on it, but it is... I'm interested to know like what the Chinese markets and audiences' reaction to this game is, because it is very intertwined with obviously Journey to the West, but it's not a retelling of the core Journey to the West story. It's more like an extended epilogue, because all the events that are happening in this game are events that have happened after the Journey to the West has already been done. Wukong already made that journey. So this is all touching upon like familiar characters and concepts from that core Journey to the West story of like life after that journey has been made. What are the consequences? What are, well, it's kind of like, obviously, like kind of like a new aspect of this this beloved story in China. So
it's like Lord of the Rings, the Third Age, taking place after the movies.
Yeah.
Or whatever. You're just following in their footsteps.
So
literally.
So people who are like more familiar and entranced and love Journey to the West and have that fresh in their memory, like, may get a lot out of this game in terms of like its plot. Obviously, I haven't done a reread of Journey to the West like in 10 million years. I read it like once, but it was a very long time ago.
What if I haven't read it, but I have watched Dragon Ball?
You'll be like, oh, dude, you get the Nimbus Cloud just like Goku in Dragon Ball.
Imagine if you said Dragon Ball Z. What if I watched Dragon Ball Z?
Yeah, it's like, where's my Super Saiyan powers? What the hell? So
when do I get the Kamehameha?
I do want to read Journey to the West, though. Like, I'm actually pulling up, like, what volumes or editions of this can I get or rent or go to the library? You know what? Maybe I'll go to my library and see what.
Yes, I mean, like, it is a pretty interesting, like, story in that aspect. That, like, for people who like that, I wonder if that, like, this really, really works for them. Because, like, again, there's a lot of Chinese style storytelling to this. It's a lot of like a very secular in nature, very high concept style of delivery and sort of stuff like that. So it's like it's not going to be the easiest to follow when you're more used to like Western style storytelling, but you know, there are still some pretty visuals, and some of the character models and some of like the way they interact with another is amusing in that respect. But it's just like, I just wasn't expecting, like, oh, you really kind of need to have intricate knowledge or intimate knowledge with the Journey to the West story to kind of really follow along with this.
Now, I'm hoping what I'm going to say now will not age well, but in Junior's review, he mentioned some parts of the game, the voice audio was either missing or the wrong language, or he was playing in English, but sometimes it would be in Chinese, sometimes it wouldn't be any voiceover at all. Did you have those technical issues?
I had some of them, but but again, there's a review copy that we're playing, a pre-release. They've been patching it, so some of those issues may have been patched already, or might be patched by when people get to play it. Obviously, Junior can only comment on what he's able to play, and there's no easy way to kind of rewind and see, like, you know, prior events that you already seen in the game. So the problems that we encountered during like languages being changed or like no audio in some of the cutscenes, those might have been fixed already, but it's hard to check unless we like did another playthrough of it.
I think all of us in this chat are familiar with when we're reviewing a game that has some bugs or issues. It's like, well, you don't want to just ignore them, but you don't want to like hammer focus in on these like it's so hard because it might be fixed in a day, you know.
And it's impossible to ignore them completely, because even if you're like, well, sure, I'm sure they'll fix these things. But then, like, if you had enough of that happen that you're not understanding the pacing of the story, then scenes that are delivered correctly on a technical level, you still might not get, because you had the... you can't divorce it completely, ever. So it kind of affects your enjoyment, and you're like, well, they're going to fix this eventually, hopefully, but I don't know that for sure, but I don't want to harp on it. It's tricky.
Yeah. I think my favorite part of Wukong, like, hands down, and I think a lot of people will share this sentiment when they play it, is... there are what the developers in the game described as music videos that play after the end of each chapter in the game. And these are basically sort of like almost like recap videos of like the story that transpired that involved parties in the chapter that you just played. So, for example, in a certain chapter, you're kind of dealing with this family affair. Of like this torn down family of like someone's dad is like on their deathbed, and then they kind of need their mother's fan to kind of fan away the flames to get to aid their like their dad in it. So after like all the events, you fight the boss in it, and you see kind of like the background events of this family of like what led up to this, and like part of that story recap is like partially how this character, the dad, was related to the Wukong as Wukong made his journey to the West. And part of it is like what this dad did after the journey ended. and how, like, you know, his relations with his family became the way that it did at the during the chapter that you just explored. So to kind of like half recap, half like retelling, like, or telling like the background story of like the involved parties of a particular chapter, and these are all done in a really, really, really beautiful fashion that's done in like in a different art style per chapter. So for the first chapter, it's like a comic style paneling for this chapter, and then in the, after the second chapter, the music video for that is like a claymation for it. It's done really, really well. It's like the claymation is like done like in almost like in a musical, like
stop motion
style. Yeah, it's done in stop motion, but it's all, there's also like a musical behind it. It's like almost like a,
I actually
a
remember song, one of the Wukong, like, it was like a mini trailer was in stop motion.
Yeah.
They're like, I remember it was like, it was like a bunny or something trying to get the game to work on his like Windows 95 PC.
Yeah. It was good. It was so good. Yeah. And then like, and then there's other music videos that have like a more traditional, like, animation style, and then like the way that like these animations are produced are like through different methods and so forth, and yeah, they all just have a different distinct art style to them, and it's like it's they're gorgeous and beautiful works of art. And like, if anything, that's kind of like the main reason I like saw the game through the end, because I really wanted to see all of them. So they're something to see, and I feel like you kind of miss some of it because if you only just like watch a compilation of it through YouTube, because like they're there to explain what you kind of just like witnessed almost. So getting no context of that kind of loses a little bit of their luster. And then after they play, there's like an intermission between between chapters that shows like a big wall painting, and you can like zoom into this like unique wall painting to kind of get like just additional like background info on what you just saw. So it's kind of a little more light exposition and teeing you up for like the next chapter to come. So that's really, really cool. That's like, that's one of those things that's like, oh, this feels authentic and unique to this game. This is like something that they really, if anything, there's like kind of, it helps distinguished identity of this game above like the rest of other.
There's no like precedent for it. They're like, oh, we think this is a neat idea. So almost, this is going to sound a little bit highbrow, but like almost like real artistry behind it, where like we have this concept, this thing we want to do with our way we deliver our story. Mm-hmm. No one else has quite done it like this. We're not playing copycat. This is something we feel like. So it does sound really neat.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I think there's just Wukong in a nutshell, just like, I think there's some solid gameplay systems. It has some really nice like visual scenery and scene composition, and some of like the way that events play out and how those like reflect in gameplay is really cool. But I think there's just enough of like this game, like in terms of like its design decisions, that really, really drag it down. Yeah, when it's good, it's pretty good. When it's bad, it's really, really bad. I guess is the easiest way I can succinctly sum it up. You know, it's a very polarizing experience, because you're enjoying it for like maybe the 20 to 30 minutes, and then like the next like 45 minutes like might just be a really, really awful slog. You know, whether it might be a boss that like you're hung up on, or it's just like an area that's just like it's just so visually dull and not fun to go through, you know. And I wonder what how people are gonna take to it. I think for some people this will be like their favorite game ever, or there might be their game of the year, but if they're able to like look past a lot of like its problems. For some other people, they're just like, this is kind of the reason why they don't like Souls-likes. You know.
Just curious, how long did it take you to beat it? Because I know there were some like fake leaked reviews that said like 90 hours long. It was
it took me under 30 hours. So yeah, my final play that was like 20
good length hours for an RPG that's not bad. Like action game.
Of course, it's not like I didn't get to see like every optional area and optional boss, because for me, I don't have a map and I don't know where I have to go to like figure these out. Like, there'll be some parts of the map that like you go into, like there's like a temple that has like a shrine point, but then like when you walk around that temple, there's nothing to interact with, and there's like, I don't know what the fuck to do, so you just go out and go about your day. Do I know where it is? I have no idea where it is now, because like once again, it'll be at some previous chapter. I have to go to some shrine, and then I need to have retained the memory of mentally mapping that place out several days ago to like remember where it is. You know, so it's just once again, the really cool game. Some really weird design decisions between like having no map, and like one really weird permanent decision type system. So I don't know. I also just want to say before we're done with this, this game has like, I'm gonna refer to you because I don't know. I generally do not know, but the way that this game does its credits is really weird, and I don't think I've seen it in any type of media before. The way it like lists its credits when you're done with the game is basically it lists it organizes it by names of people and the year they either joined or contributed to the project. So for example, like the credits start with 2020, this list of names. 2021, this list of names. 2022, this list of names. It's only names. There's no credit of like what they actually did. It's just a list of names and a year.
That is interesting. Different.
I don't think I've seen that before either.
I don't know if I would say that's bad because it's still giving people credit and whatnot. But yeah, I've never seen that.
Yeah, I don't know if they do this in Chinese cinema or if it is like a common practice somewhere else. I don't know. But it's just like when I saw, I was like, I've never seen this type of way of crediting before.
The only thing I remember from Chinese cinema is like at the end of the credits, I don't know why they list a year in Roman numerals. It'll be like copyright XX, like something, something, something. And you're like,
whoa, that's crazy.
It's like, why the hell did they do it in Roman numerals?
Okay, that's bizarre too. So yeah, that was kind of like my final thought on it. It's like, oh, that's kind of, and then, yeah. So I don't know. It's kind of, I'm very interested to see like what the wider public thinks, and I definitely want to hear from like you know people over there in China, like what they think about this, because like you know the game science has positioned this as like we really want this to be like this the AAA game that really showcases like how what the Chinese game industry is capable of, you know. So we'll see. I don't know. I have no idea.
And then we do have the written review up on the site, rpgsite.net, from Junior. And during, at least based on the discussions you guys have had behind the scenes, it seems like you guys agree on most things, and that's not inherently good or bad. You know, some reviewers agree and some don't. But we do have Junior's specific thoughts written out on the website, if you want to give those a read. And then, of course, we have this podcast to document Josh's thoughts, and maybe, you know, I'm sure we'll bring it up again, at least in a abbreviated fashion at the end of the year when we talk about figuring out which ones in our top 10.
Yeah, and if anyone else plays it, like you know, I'd love to talk a little bit about them, because like right now I know it's like behind the scenes, like you know, I'm still kind of working on it, like to do some like light guide stuff. But I know Junior's like, I've mentally checked out of this game. I'm done. I wanna continue living my life. It's like, I get it. I totally get
it. Sometimes when you finish a game within 24 hours of embargo and you gotta write up a review and get it, you know, actually sound meaningful and get it's a lot. It can be draining. So yeah, I feel for Junior.
Yeah.
So thank you, Josh, for going over the release of Black Myth Wukong. When looking at other games to talk about for this podcast, here's one that it's been on my back burner for the entire year, and I finally got to it. It came out last December, so for in purview of our site, it does count as a 2024 game. I finally played and finished Owlcat's Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader. So this came out last December. I had put it off and put it off, and then I said maybe I'll play through it in May, and then I put it off, and then finally August gave me a time to play it. So I finally cleared it over the last couple, you know, 2.5 weeks. That's why I've not really talked about any other game in that window. So I won't spend a ton of time on this game because this is quite belated, but it is our first and real chance to talk about it at length. But to try to tee up the conversation just so too many eyes don't glaze over, because when this game was first announced, my honest reaction was, oh, they're doing a Warhammer game? I don't know anything about Warhammer. I don't know if I want to know anything about Warhammer. Isn't that IP that gets like two new mid games a year? And I know some of the games have been received pretty well. Vermintide 2, I know, has a really strong following. I know a lot of people are excited for Space Marine 2. It's coming out in, what, a month or two? Not an RPG, but a third-person shooter. And so here's, like, a studio that's made a couple cult, you know, favorite CRPGs of a different IP. Now they're working on Warhammer. So that's going to be the perspective of how I talk about here, is that for anyone listening who has not skipped past to the next timestamp, I don't know anything about Warhammer other than the 80 hours that I spent with this game. I did not like go onto like a Wikipedia or a fandom.com deep dive to like educate myself. So my understanding of this universe is as it is presented in this game, no other prior history. So if I say things that are like shallow or a base level understanding, like that's kind of the perspective I'm coming from, which I think is not going to be too unusual because there really haven't been a lot of, most of the Warhammer games have been of like the action or the shooter variety, is my understanding. This is the first like full fat RPG of this IP. So that's where I'm coming at this from. And of course, like I said, it came out last December, but Owlcat and all of their releases have earned a reputation of games coming in very, 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 very hot in terms of being cut content, bugged, not
being said this before. Your Kingmaker review, you're probably getting to this. You literally ran into a game-breaking bug and you couldn't finish it.
Exactly. And then even in the process of this game, I've gone, I didn't play this game with any sort of guide or anything, but I did Google a few things, go to the Steam forums or the, I think it has a Fetch for Life wiki, and people have said, like, based on my interpretation of posts and messages from like that December, January, February timeframe when the first game first came out, the game is divided into a prologue and five chapters. Prologue, chapter one, chapter two, and even chapter three are pretty good. And apparently chapter four and chapter five were in dire straits in terms of bugginess, technical proficiency when the game first launched. And that doesn't surprise me at all. It's like, that's not, I look at that and like, of course that's how it was. But luckily my time playing through Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader in August wasn't bad. It was not bug free, but compared to my time with Kingmaker and Wrath of the Righteous, it might as well have been, because like all my quests completed just fine. I didn't get anything stuck in the log. All the bugs that I did encounter were mostly cosmetic or not very consequential. But anyways, enough about like the release of the game, about like the setup and what the game is. This is a turn-based isometric CRPG. So the point of comparison I have to make, I'm sorry, is Baldur's Gate. And it's not actually a bad comparison, because Baldur's Gate 3 specifically, obviously Larian took a big swing to make it a purely turn-based game from a series that used to be real-time with pause. And of course, this is not a series, but Owlcat's other games were originally launched as real-time with pause games, so that's very classic Baldur's Gate, with eventually they got post-update turn-based modes. I would have to clear the cobwebs a bit, but I think it was a mod that was eventually like blessed by the studio. Either that, I know it came after, it was a post-launch update to add turn-based, so you could play the game in turn-based, but it wasn't really designed for turn-based, the original two Pathfinder games. In a way where one of my core memories of Wrath of the Righteous, and I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, like 2.5 years ago, is that there's a certain side quest in that game where you're fighting like a tactician type character. So the gimmick of the fight is that you have to do it in turn-based mode, because it's supposed to be like, you know, you're on a chessboard and you're out strategizing this character. And it was terrible. It took hours, because real-time with pause just flows differently. The way that the combat just flows from buffing to the number of enemies to how much damage you deal per round is just very different. And I'm like, God, this would suck to play in turn-based mode. And I know a lot of people have played those games in turn-based mode, but it was never pleasant for me. I'm happy to say that in Rogue Trader, it's completely turn-based. That's the only option you have, and it fits very well. And if this is what Owlcat goes with for the rest of their projects, I am completely happy with that. And that's, of course, a combination of preference. It's a combination of playing a game in turn-based that was designed to be in turn-based. It's a combination of a lot of things. But
you don't have to give the specifics, but is it sort of like Baldur's Gate, where you can like move a certain distance and then perform an action, or, you know,
very,
like
very similar. Yeah. Okay. And I know that's not like, that's not, you know, there's, this isn't the wheel being reinvented. A lot of games have like a, you have a movement allowance and then you have an action allowance of some sort. And then the way those two things interact, depending on the game, can be like, you can convert one to the other, or you can move then act, or if you're a certain, if you have a certain talent, you can move then act then move. And that's kind of how this is, like, basically, it does the thing that any good turn-based RPG should do, is that you have a set turn order based on your initiative and based on, like, your stats, but then you eventually and slowly unlock ways to manipulate the turn order. Like, certain characters have certain roles that they can, like, bequeath a bonus turn to another character, or if an enemy dies under a certain set of parameters, you get an extra movement. You know, things like that. And it ends up working really, really well from, like, design standpoint. And the game, the battles, I never felt like any individual battle took more than 20 minutes, which you can't say for that Wrath of the Righteous if you play that in turn-based mode. In general, I played this game on the normal default settings. In any Pathfinder game, you have tons of knobs and sliders to really dial in what you want the challenge to be. Like, what is the enemy's chance to critical hit? How much health do they have compared to their baseline? 100%, or they can have less, or they can have more. How much damage do you do? Like, you can fine tune this completely, but I just picked like the normal preset setup, and it was pretty easy. So basically, this game, I think, on its normal difficulty, is easier than their other two games. And I think a lot of that is due to the fact that Pathfinder, I'm not sure if this is the way Owlcat designed it, or if it's the way that they adapted it from the tabletop game. The Pathfinder games are really strongly built of, you have to buff your characters first, you got to do your boons, you got to do your debuffs, you got to cast Bless and Bane, you know, those sorts of things, in order for you to have a good time. Where here, there's a little bit of that, but also, you can vary, at least on the normal difficulty, go into this character that is designed around doing a lot of damage very quickly, and you can start doing that as early as the first round, so to speak. So that kind of fits my playstyle a little bit better. But in terms of the story, first of all, like I said, this is my first time anything Warhammer, but the general, for those that have no idea and need to be teed up, everything in Warhammer 40K from my initial experience with the IP is that everything is very, very big and very, very old. Like the main ship, it's called the main ship on this, in this game, is the Void Ship. And that's kind of like your key, like base, your point of operations in this game. It seems like it is so old that it's not quite sure. Like, it's so old that it might as well has always been there. Like, we don't know who built it. It's got so much history that more history has been lost than remembered. That's kind of like the whole vibe of Warhammer 40K, is that it's so far in the future that so many things just are. Like, this Void Ship has thousands of people living on it, and they have lived on it for generations. We don't know who built the ship. We don't know who the first people on it were. It's just a fixture of the universe. And that's true for the planets, the ships, the civilizations. And that might not be true in every individual case, but that's kind of the way it's delivered in the story. You are a distant relation to a character who is a high-ranking member of the Imperium. The Imperium is basically like, imagine the Enclave or the Brotherhood of Steel from Fallout, only much older, much bigger, and much more like fascist. Even though those two organizations are pretty fascist.
I'm sure Warhammer fans are going to love this description.
But like, the Imperium basically has a leader called the God Emperor. There's statues of him everywhere. You don't ever meet him explicitly in this game, but it's one of those things where, again, it's so big and so old that it's always been in power. They always have had the power. They are what humans follow. It is their religion, it is their government, it is their everything. And anything other than that is a Xenos or a heretic or an agent of chaos. But the one thing that I wasn't expected, and if you're not in Warhammer like verse, I wasn't expecting this going in, the title of Rogue Trader Capital is almost like an emperor or a king in their own right. They aren't like a Spectre in Mass Effect or like a Jedi in Star Wars. They're bigger than that. They basically are a king with their own solar system that reports to them. It is a hereditary position. So like Rogue Traders, sorry, he choked on my snack. Rogue Traders basically pass down their power through like a rite of passage, like a monarchy. And that's what they are. And that's what your player character in this game ends up inheriting. You become a Rogue Trader at the untimely death of Theodora von Valencia.
So you're like an ultra mob boss or something?
Kind of. You're like a mob boss slash emperor slash king sort of thing. You have worlds that report to you, and they have reported to you for generations. And you are like immensely, immensely, immensely wealthy. And I'll talk about how that comes into play in terms of the gameplay in a bit. But the one thing about this story that is really well done, I actually think, is that there is a prologue where basically the events that I just kind of discussed take place. You're aboard this void ship that belongs to Theodora, and then shit goes down, and before you know it, you're in charge of it. And you basically inherit everything. Her power, her longstanding like accomplishments, the people who report to you, the whole planets that basically see you as their sovereign, you inherit all of it. So you, at the start of the game, it's kind of very much a power fantasy. It's not like you're coming from nothing like a lot of RPGs do. You're immediately thrust into it. And early on in the prologue and in chapter one, one key aspect of Warhammer 40K is the idea of the warp. And it goes through a bunch of other names. It is basically a, like, I hope I described this well, it's like a metaphysical realm that exists alongside the realm that we occupy. And it is what is utilized for these void ships, that's why they're called void ships, to travel long distances immediately. However, the void is basically full of chaotic, unknowing elements that they're almost indescribable, at least in the way it's presented in Rogue Trader, where in order to have a spaceship do warp travel, you are immediately exposing thousands of people to agents of chaos, to the agents of the void. They're basically like demons. It's like a demon realm that the human Imperium has tried to like put into their own arrest for their use and for their purposes. People that can access the demon realm are called psykers, and they use that to cast magic or to summon beings or thralls or whatever.
You're saying this, it just makes me think of like the Fade.
I was actually just going to say that. Okay. If I had to make a point of comparison, it's the Dragon Age Fade. That's basically what it is. Like, it's not the perfect comparison, but if you think of the Void as the Fade that allows you to warp travel, you're not far off. And basically, if a planet succumbs to void degradation and the agents of the Fade start corrupting the people that have accessed it to not carefully enough, then usually the way that is dealt with is that people are executed, planets are destroyed in order to prevent the spread. Like, that's the safest, that's the ideal, that's the best thing to do. That is the most kind thing you can do, is to, you know, nip it at the bud sort of thing whenever the agents of chaos or the void start leaking into the physical realm. And in chapter one of the game, that's basically what you're dealing with, is a star system that is succumbing itself to that. And then there are a lot of big events happen in chapter one, including like you deal with a cult called the Cult of the Final Dawn. They have a cult leader, and it's pretty good escalation in terms of like, it starts out that you have like a single antagonist, and then it ends up being, and this happens early on in the game relatively, a star is removed from its solar system. A star is stolen. And that's kind of like the big kickoff. Like, holy shit. Like, what, how did that happen? Why would that happen? What are the consequences of that? Now everything's like, and agents of chaos are spilling out of the void. And then, strangely enough, for the middle three chapters of the game, that kind of takes a back seat as you just kind of learn about like the different protectorates that are under your dynasty in terms of like the different planets, the different star systems. You end up meeting the Eldari and the Drukhari, which are like two alien races and factions. You learn a little bit more about the Imperium, about the Inquisitors, and it almost seems like relatively small scale after that fact. And then this game does a really good job in chapter five at the very end tying it all back together. It's like the way that the story scale is paced is actually really, really good. I was quite impressed with it. In terms of how the gameplay progresses, the moment-to-moment combat is turn-based, isometric. If you played Baldur's Gate, if you played Wasteland 3, you've got a general idea. It's grid-based. You have a party of six characters. It's a class-based game. I'll talk about that in a little bit. And, you know, you usually encounter, like, remember in Mass Effect, I believe 2, you go from star system to star system and you go to planets and you scan them and you send out probes and you get resources. Yeah. It has a little bit of that. Only certain star systems you can land on. You can explore ruins. And even though a lot of the marketing of this game is kind of like 1990s or early 2000s, like too edgy 5me or whatever, there actually is a lot of, like, early on in the game, you end up on like a snow planet, you end up on a jungle planet, you end up on a planet with like old ancient, like medieval ruins. Like, there's actually quite a bit of variety of the things you see, though there are a lot of like industrial, not quite steampunk, more like, I don't know, diesel punk, retro future punk, that sort of aesthetic, the Warhammer 40k aesthetic. So there is a lot of that, but there is some variety as well. The way that the classes work in this game is quite different, and I wanted to at least draw a little bit of attention to it. So in a lot of games that are tabletop RPGs or based off tabletop RPGs or designed in a similar way, it's pretty common to have like a race, an origin, and then a class. Like, I am a dwarf, a defender that is of this sub-race or whatever. Like, if you play Baldur's Gate 3, it's the same idea. A paladin that worships a certain sect of that order or whatever. But the way that it works slightly different in Rogue Trader, and I don't know if this is based off the Warhammer miniatures game or not, or if this is something Owlcat came up with, I'm not sure. But in this game, on paper, it sounds very similar. You have an origin, you have a home world, and then you have an archetype. And I know that's a lot of words spat out, so let me try to dial it in. Your home world basically says, like, are you from a forge world? Are you from a dead world? What sort of planet are you from? And that will help determine some basic statistics about like your parameters, your attributes, and some feats that you can access. So that's pretty by the book and pretty well worn. Then you have an origin. Now, this is where it gets really different. Like, you have a couple player selectable origins, and these are things like, you're a Navy officer, you're a crime lord, you're a noble, you're a military commander, you're a navigator. And these things are almost like classes in their own right. It's not just like, oh, I'm an elf, therefore I get plus intelligence, minus constitution, or whatever. It's like, if you are a navigator, you have access to a ton of talents that other characters don't get. If you are a noble, if you are a Navy officer, you get access to a ton of talents that other characters don't get. And then on top of that, you have an archetype. An archetype is more like a traditional class. You are a soldier. You are an officer. And so the combination of your origin and your archetype really kind of make each character quite unique. Like, you might have two officers in your party, but if one is a noble officer and one is a navigator officer, they play completely differently, but they might occupy the same role. So I know that's a lot of like really trying to dial into like real gear grind and mechanics. But the nice thing about that is that it kind of gives it a little bit more complexity in terms of just saying like, oh, these two characters are the same class, therefore they're going to play the same way. It's like, well, no, you could probably build two officers quite differently based on their home world and their origin. And then in addition to this, there's a lot of origins that are bespoke to certain characters that are in your party. So there's like, I think I got like 9 characters in my party by the time all said and done. And like half of them had unique origins. Like, you'll get a character named Pasquale, who is like a tech priest, a Brotherhood of Mars. I'm blurting out Warhammer terms that people who know Warhammer might know.
And his, I love jargon.
And his origin is unique to him. You'll get an Asriani on your party who her origin is Asriani Outcast. So it's like the origins, some of them are like picked from a list, and you might have multiple people that are, quote, Navy officers, and it's a little bit more boilerplate. But then the game goes one step further and says, here's an origin that is bespoke to this person. It is unique to them. Only they will get this based on that her history. And so that it just makes it feel like you have a party of 9, 10, 11 characters, but they all are, unless you're really deliberately trying to make them identical, they all really serve quite different roles in combat. And not only combat, like, just like Baldur's Gate 3, there's a lot of like athletics checks, tech checks, medicine checks, demolition checks, like just exploring, navigating, going throughout the world. And a lot of these are quite, like, the flavor of these things are quite different because, you know, you might try to draw analogs to Baldur's Gate or Pathfinder or whatever, and in some cases you can, but in a lot of cases you really can't. Like, for instance, the Navigator origin, navigators are basically mutants that have, like, the intellectual ability in order to help ships navigate through the perils of the warp, the fade that I described earlier. And because of that, they have certain attributes to what they look like, how they behave, their personalities, and how they can be used in combat. Like, it's like, and there's really, like, I can't say a navigator is like, and then try to draw a point of comparison, because there really isn't any good ones. So it's you can kind of try to explain it at a high level, but you really kind of have to play it to really understand what it is. You do get one space marine in your party, which is pretty fun. And they're basically, they're a little bit more, they're like a berserker, the brute, at least the one you get in this game. Let's see, I don't want to dive too deeply into any one individual thing. In terms of like, oh, here's one thing I'll go into. One thing that I've kind of bemoaned about Owlcat games before is that they very much like to have the kitchen sink approach. You'll have your basic exploration, your basic combat, and then you'll have like subsystems upon subsystems upon subsystems that in Pathfinder Kingmaker and Wrath of the Righteous.
Did you like the Crusades?
No, I hated the Crusade battles. Wrath of the Righteous, for all this, the, in terms of like subsystems, I really felt like Wrath of the Righteous had too much bloat. I didn't like the Heroes of Might and Magic style, like Crusade battles. Pathfinder Kingmaker was a little better with like the light town building elements. I think that was just something that I like a little bit more. Here, there's two things that they have, and I kind of liked both of them, I think, more than both Pathfinder games. There is your void ship itself. You have a series of void ship battles. So it's still isometric. It's still turn-based. But instead of controlling your party, you control your ship. And you can like deck out who in your party is your weapon master, your engineer, you know, your captain. And they have different bonuses to like who you assign to what ship role. You can like deck out like your starboard cannons, your port torpedo launchers, your engine, your shields. And it's complex enough to feel worthwhile, but it's simple enough and straightforward enough that it doesn't feel like you have to play a whole second game in order to do it. That's the third part I really didn't like about the Crusade battles, is that you could like have monsters or demons or devils on your team, and you'd have to manage two wholly separate things within a single game, which you might say, well, that's just an intricate game, get good. But in this game, it really feels a lot more complementary. The other thing that you get is you get colonies. So you'll have planets that they're in kind of like your protectorate for your dynasty that you've inherited as rogue trader. And basically you spend resources to upgrade these colonies. They give you various bonuses. Some of these bonuses can be passive and they're in battle. Some of them are a little bit more tangible. Like one of the bonuses you can get pretty early on is a companion, like in the ship battles. Normally the ship battles is just your void ship, your one ship against whatever the enemy fleet is. But one of the colonies, if you build it up in a certain way, you can get like an allied ship. So it's like, oh, that's kind of neat. A lot of the benefits are passive. If I have any detractions about the colony system, is that I think it's almost too passive. There's a one point where you're just like, you're spending resources in a menu and you're building. You don't see any of this tangibly. It's all menu based. Like you're building barracks, you're building scouts, you're building up these colonies. And as you build it up, it's like you get plus critical chance, plus accuracy. You get more temporary HP when you do certain things. And at one point you have so many passives that my eyes were like glazing over. I'm just like, sure, I'm sure this will all help me. I'm just, as I build up my colonies, I'm up to like 20 or 30 little passive bonuses that all stack up and make me better in combat. And there, I almost kind of would have felt like less would have been more. Some of the passives, like, what do you get from this colony? What do you get from this colony? And what do you get from this? And like, I don't know. I get like 8 or 9 from each of them, and they all just become a giant list of things at some point. So that's, if I were to redesign the game, I almost would have made it fewer passives that were more impactful, rather than they just shit them out and you just get all of them. And it kind of makes it, I think that's what contributed to me thinking that the game felt kind of easy. Is that you end up with so many different little passive bonuses that I couldn't even keep track of them all, not easily. In terms of technical things, I'm glad I waited, like I said. I still had a few bugs, and a few of them were like, I invited a character to come aboard my void ship, and then he would stand there on my bridge. And then I don't know if this was intended design or not, but like, you could not speak to them. He had no dialogue. He had no more anything else to say. He was just standing in a location on my bridge, and he didn't have any, you could not interact with him in any way. He was just standing there, but he had like a nameplate like he wasn't like a generic crewmate. He had a nameplate and like a title, and you just couldn't talk to them him at all. There was another point where like I was in a room, and I actually showed Adam this. I was sneaking around, and I like did kind of like the stealth approach, and I basically vented a bunch of poisonous gas into a room in order to kill all the enemies without initiating real combat. And I did that, but then there was one enemy in the corner that wasn't dead. He wouldn't interact with me in any way. He just somehow avoided the gas, and he just sat there. And then there's a system in the game called the rumors. Rumors are kind of like, they're not really quests in their own right. They're like, hey, you found a data shard that mentioned that there's a crashed ship on this planet or in this system. If you go there, you might be able to find something. And in a lot of cases, the rumors would kind of check off your list, kind of like quests, as soon as you would like succeed at them. Oh, you found the thing. Oh, you followed up on this rumor to its endpoint. But then there are some that just wouldn't. So I'd have a rumor, and on my UI, it'd be like, there's a crashed ship on this planet. You should go there. I'm like, I've already been there. Like, there's a giant green question mark on it. And I'm like, I know I've already done that. But the thing that makes it confusing is that I would look at my map, and there'd be like 8 or 9 green question marks, and I'd be like, well, I don't know which ones I've seen or which one I haven't, because they're not checking off my list like they're supposed to be. So in terms of game breaking bugs, it's nothing catastrophic, but it still is lacking a little bit of that polish. And the fact that we're 8 months from release is a little disappointing, but I'm also kind of not surprised. I've seen on the Steam forums and other places, you're like, welcome to late game Owlcat. That just is how it is. You put up with it. So that was my experience on a technical front. And then on a progression front, I think this is the last major thing I have to say. Speaking of comparisons to Dragon Age and the Fade, in chapter 3 of this game, you pick a party of 6 people, because that's a standard party size, and you are basically, for story reasons, removed from your ship. You're isolated. You have no access to your colonies or your convoys or anything like that. It's just you and your party stuck for the whole chapter trying to get out. It's really kind of effective in terms of making you feel isolated, making you feel like you have to really be careful with your resources. You just can't go back to your ship and change your party or heal up. And I've seen, and it's quite linear compared to the rest of the game. I actually quite liked it. It was one of those things that was stressful in a good way. It really kind of kept you on your toes and really kind of felt like it was straining you and making sure that you knew you were aware of everything that was going on in terms of, I got to stay healthy because I don't have access to these resources. I got to carefully use my med kits, carefully use my what I have. But then I saw some people say, like, this is just the Fade from Dragon Age Origins, only worse. So I've seen that go both ways. So that's chapter 3 of this game, is that it kind of deviates from, the game sets you up to expect a certain progression, and then in chapter 3, it completely deviates from it and says, well, be flexible, dude, make do. So would I recommend this game to people that don't know Warhammer or don't think they vibe with just the aesthetics of the game? And I guess my answer to that is, if you really liked, and again, I have to invoke this comparison, I'm sorry, if you really liked Baldur's Gate 3 from a gameplay perspective, in terms of how that game progressed, how the maps looked, how the party composition worked, as an RPG, if you really like that, then I really do think you would like Rogue Trader. If you liked Baldur's Gate 3 more for its story and characters and vibe, then maybe Rogue Trader, I'm not saying you wouldn't like it, but it doesn't feel like Baldur's Gate 3 in that front, more from a mechanical front, does it? So I'm glad I played it. I will probably also, I'm speaking into the microphone now before I've actually written up a review. So I'm going to do that as well, hopefully within the next 3 days. So I will eventually on RPGsite.net, by the time you listen to this, I might have a written review up on the site. It'll probably just repeat a lot of the things I've said here. But it's definitely my favorite time with an Owlcat game so far, though I think that's half due to me just waiting to play it. I think I would have thought a lot more poorly on it if I had played it when it launched. But I guess that's kind of my concluding remarks, and I think I've kind of touched on everything. I feel like I've given a lecture. Are there any questions?
I mean, you did a really, really great job, like just providing a comprehensive breakdown of like what your experience of that game.
Yeah, no, you did a great job.
Yeah, it sounds really, really awesome. I didn't know about the void ship battles. I thought it was really just the characters duking it out. But that seems really, really cool. And this is also an opportune time. But I mean, Owlcat Games has like a crazy, crazy Humble Bundle deal going on, so people who are interested in giving this game a shot, can not only get that at a discounted price, but basically the whole Alcat Games catalog for a big discount, right, Brian?
Yeah, it's like $32 for all their games, all the DLC for the Kingmaker and Wrath of the Righteous games, and also a bunch of Beamdog games, like the definitive editions of Baldur's Gate 1 and 2, a few other things, Planescape Torments, I think, in there. So all of those classic isometric RPGs that we've kind of had the renaissance for in the last like half decade are all in a Humble Bundle for like $32. I forget what the exact tiers are, but it's live on Humble Bundle right now. So it's like, before we started recording, you're like $30 for like 800 hours of gameplay. Like,
yeah, 30 hours, yeah.
that might be shortchanging it. I guess that's one thing I should say, is that compared to the other two Alcat games I played, Rogue Trader, playing start to finish and doing like all the things I could, was a brisk 80 hours. So it's not short. I think for Wrath of the Righteous, I think it was 110, and I played through that once. So it's shorter than Wrath of the Righteous. The one thing I will say about the story, not more the lore than the story, is that the one thing that was the hardest to acclimate to is learning all the different factions in this game, because they're all very old. They've all been around a long time in the universe of Warhammer 40K, and they all often go by a lot of different names, which I think is good in terms of like establishing them as real tangible components of the world building. But that, just as one example, one of the characters you get, Pasquale, he is a tech priest. He's like a character who was once human, but now is more machine than human. And he's been machine for so long that he doesn't know like who he once was as a human. He's always been a machine. The tech priests are part of a group of people that are colloquially known as like the priesthood of Mars, who is also known as the Adeptus Mechanicus, who has a group of like a faction within that called the Explorators. And like, imagine there's 6 or 7 different factions in the game that are all like that. Like the Imperium, who has a group of that works under them called the Inquisitors, of which under that there's this other group. Or the Adeptus Soritas, who also is known as the Sisters of Battle, who is also blah, blah, blah. Like, and the thing is that was probably the hardest part for me, is not having any prior history of that. And even in the game, there's a part where it's like, oh, this character isn't a mere serpent. They're a Cariad, I think is the name, Cariad, I believe. And that hadn't shown up previously, and it's not elucidated on, where like, if you know Warhammer, you might be like, aha, I know what that is. But in terms of this game, you're like, I don't know what that is. Like, it's a revelation, but I don't know what that is. So as someone who doesn't know Warhammer, that's the thing that I struggled with the most. I think I got
So what you're saying to, like, is I need to go out and play all the other, like, 6 dozen Warhammer games before I play this.
Yeah, you gotta like
only the 40K one.
Oh, it wasn't Cariad. It was Cadian, Cadian. So there's a character who is like, oh, they aren't a mere serpent; they're a Cadian, and I guess it's like some sort of like warrior faction that doesn't really play a big role in this game, because this game takes place in kind of its own separate section of like the universe. But clearly, it's supposed to be like a nod for like. And I actually kind of like that. Like, oh, this world is bigger than what the vertical slice you're given. The game doesn't have to go into like, here's everything about that faction, because it doesn't come into play. It just is. And there's characters that are mentioned off screen, like the leader of the Drukhari. His name is Vect, V-E-C-T. He is shown and referenced as a very big, important character. I never ran into him, and I think that's just fine. Like, it's the world is bigger than this one story we're telling within it. And I think that's for an IP that's been around as long as Warhammer, I think that makes perfect sense.
But, did you try this on your Steam Deck at all?
I did not try it on my Steam Deck. I played it on PC. I did try the gamepad controls a little bit, and they worked okay. Like I prefer mouse and keyboard. I think the fact that it's turn based really helps. Playing a real time with pause game on a gamepad to me sounds a nightmare. But turn based game, I think it seems fine. This game did make my PC run quite hot, and I Google it. If you Google like Rogue Trader PC hot or whatever, you might get some fun fan art, but also you'll see people say like, this game is burning up my CPU, what's with it? And a lot of people just say like, oh, that's just because it's a Unity game. Just cap the frame rate at 60 and you'll be fine. So yeah, I capped the frame rate at 60 just because it was making my CPU run hot and just kind of like heating up my room a little bit. So in terms of like technical like frame rate, and like I never really crashed a desktop, never had any glitches. It ran well on my computer, but my computer is also probably overkill for it. I don't know how well it would run on a more modest machine, but it did run hot. and I did cap it at 60 FPS, which probably helped my performance a little bit. So it ran pretty well on the gamepad.
I think anyone listening to this podcast, like hearing us talk about PC performance of games, should take that for a grain of salt, because three of us have 4090s. Josh has a 3080, and Chow, you have like a 7800 XT, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are all pretty high end. So it's like, just keep that in mind.
Yeah. Sorry, we're elite PC gamers in here.
But Rogue Trader, I enjoyed it a lot. I don't think it makes the top 10 this year, but it's I'm glad
you're already calling it holy.
Well, okay. We'll see. I haven't read my review yet, so we'll let my thoughts coalesce, and we'll see how I feel after I write that up.
That's it. I gotta get a hop on this game and become as strong as Defender.
I've been actually been meaning, how do I put this? All of the Alkai games sound interesting to me, but it's just like, man, these are a big hurdle.
The only thing I play is Vermintide 2. I haven't played anything else.
Well, Vermintide 2 is not Alcat. That's Fat Shark.
Is it? I don't know. I thought it was Alcat for a second.
No, Alcat is just a Pathfinder, and this one Warhammer game.
So. I would be curious to see if Alcat works on original IP. I mean, they kind of are in the new publishing space, and I guess more on that later. What a transition into news. So, yeah.
Yeah, but also just Warhammer-related wise, like, Space Marine 2 is around the corner, and I'm so excited. Fuck. So
My younger brother was actually looking. He doesn't play on PC, and I do. So he's looking for games that have like co-op, multiplayer, crossplay. And he's like, "Hey, have you heard of this game called Space Marine 2? We should play that."
Hell yeah!
Like, neither of us know anything about Warhammer, but like, hey,
it's just a good time. It's just a fun time either way.
And I guess I didn't even talk about like the different I don't know, religions, mantras, Paragon Renegade. Like, there's a lot. I could talk about that game for a long time, I suppose. But like, I had mentioned, I guess I brought it up very briefly last week when I said I was like halfway done with the game. It's the Warhammer universe is fucked up, and so many people are pieces of shit, and it's very hard to be a good person. Though you can be in Rogue Trader, you can be a relatively good person, and actually the game does kind of reward you for it. It's the iconoclast, basically. I don't know what you would call it. Attribute. You can either be an iconoclast, which is basically saying like you go against the Imperium, you actually respect people of different races. Surprise. And then there's dogmatic, which is basically the Imperium can do no wrong. Anything that goes against it should immediately be executed. And then there's heretic, which is like, I love Agents of Chaos. Give me all the power of the warp. I don't care what happens to me or my comrades. Power is the end all be all. So, but you can be a good person. And one thing, there is one clever thing I wanted to point out as kind of like a closing statement, is that this game is a true RPG in the sense that you get a series of companions. These companions you have interactions with through different specific quests, or you bring them on the main quest and you can kind of like try to influence their decision making. And like a lot of, I think the original Pillars of Eternity, or maybe it was Deadfire, seemed to first popularize this. I'm not going to say they're the first ones to do it, but there's a lot of dialogue in this game, and there's a lot of tool tips in terms of like, what does this feat or skill do? But also like, they mention a character off screen or an event that happened in the past, and you can hover over it to get a little bit of additional detail. In addition to that, if you've made a decision in the past that is affecting the outcome of quests that you're doing, you know, in the present, it'll actually give you a piece of blue text and say like, your decisions have made this character more merciful, or you spared so-and-so's life on this planet. That's why they're doing this for you now. Or you never learned the language of this person. That's why you can't
toggle that on or off now.
No, I mean, you could just not hover over the blue text.
Okay. I guess so. But like, I just, for some reason, sometimes I don't like a game pointing out like the consequences of my action directly. I kind of just like it having. I like it playing out more organically and naturally, like without me knowing. It's kind of like Thaumaturge, for example.
You might be able to turn it off, but you really do kind of have to like buy into it. Like, there's got to be a text box on your left, and you got to move your cursor over a blue word or two to see why it's blue, and then it'll say like, you did this and you did this. And from what I can tell, a lot of the companions will have multiple endings depending on, did you push them to be more merciful? Did you say they should get revenge? Or are you leaning into their natural dispositions? Or are you trying to steer them to a new course? And that seems really cool. One way that the game does play with this, in the somewhere around the middle that I thought was really, really clever is that you're basically having like a metaphysical like nightmare sequence where you're on trial and you're basically being accused of being why everything has gone to shit. And then there's some blue text and you hover over it and it's like, yep, you deserve this. And like the blue text kind of is breaking the fourth wall in a way where it's like, yeah, that was your fault. Yeah, you did this. And it's kind of like gaslighting you. Like not only the story of the game
gaslighting you.
Yeah, not only the story of the game, but the UI of the game for that one moment is like, yeah, you did this. Yeah, that was totally your fault. You did that. You don't remember or things like that. And like, yeah, this is the only outcome that makes sense. And that I thought was a really cool, like, moment of storytelling. And I kind of talked about how the story flows in this game. I really thought it's well done in general, more so than Wrath of the Righteous End or Pathfinder Kingmaker.
And this game also supports like co-op too, right?
I don't know. I genuinely have no idea.
Okay, I think they mentioned it at least on PC version. I think it does have co-op. So yeah. I wonder if it's like that's full integration. That's funny. Yeah. If people are just like, yeah, we have this like 80 plus hour campaign just playing it together, like that's sick.
I wonder how many people
a bunch of people. Yeah, I was gonna say like Baldur's Gate 3. Plenty of people have done like playthroughs.
Yeah, I mean it's awesome.
But yeah, so hopefully those that are real Warhammer chads, hopefully I didn't misinterpret anything too grievously, but that, you know, I enjoyed my time with it. And it's kind of a universe that's not like any other in terms of like, oh, it's like Star Trek, but, or it's like, why am I blanking on it? Warframe, but, or Wasteland, that's what I was thinking of, but it's something that kind of feels wholly
unique. I really like that that's kind of like the charm of the Warhammer IP. It's like, it's super fucked up, but like, there's a handful of games like the Rogue Trader and the Space Marine games and Vermintide. There's just like a hand, like, and like even like there's like a strategy RPG tactics game that like there's like a handful of like Warhammer games that like you can still enjoy them without understanding like, you know, the greater Warhammer universe because they're just so solid fundamentally on the gameplay that like you're able to still get sucked into it.
I think one of the coolest things that one of those Warhammer games has done is that Vermintide 1, when Vermintide 2 was announced, I guess like right before it released, they released a free like kind of like a prologue / epilogue mission for Vermintide 1. And when you load into it, at first you're like, wait, what's going on? Because you're still in the hub. And then the hub gets overrun by the rats.
Oh, that's sick. That's awesome.
Yeah, I look forward to a review. I'm going to say it while recording, so that encourages me to write it.
Yeah, for people who are interested... once again, there's a Humble Bundle up right now with Alcat Games and a few others from Beamdog. That's just like, it's an insane, insane value. Cannot emphasize that enough. You get a lot of fucking game for a very, very low price.
So heading off into the news, a lot of updates for some previously announced games. A couple of games that weren't announced this week, but... we're covering on our site for the first time, so it's our first time quite announcing them in terms of our site or our podcast. But we're opening up here with probably like the biggest headline for our purview of the week, and that is that we had kind of a countdown and a teaser that we would finally get the release date of Dragon Age: The Veilguard this week. Without bearing the lead, the release date is October 31st, which is kind of right in the window that they said it would. Obviously, Dragon Age: The Veilguard, we've talked about over the summer, got rebranded from Dreadwolf to Veilguard. We had kind of that strange original presentation that did not go down well, where it looked almost like a hero shooter. We had some behind-the-scenes stuff that showed some gameplay that people were trying to parse. We had some Game Informer-specific coverage that ended up
rest in peace
feeling kind of strange because of what happened.
No longer exists online anymore.
And so it's been a weird couple months for Dragon Age or Dragon Age related headlines. But yeah, October 31st. And alongside this, we got a release date trailer that, to my perception, has been received pretty well. I've seen some people say like, hey, I'm actually feeling sort of excited for this game, or why didn't they lead with this? So it's basically if this was the announcement trailer, I feel like it would have landed pretty well because it kind of ties into Trespasser, which of course was the last DLC for Inquisition that kind of teed the future of the franchise. It kind of introduces a lot of the party members. There's a lot to dig in there for like Dragon Age fans, either current or lapsed. And it shows a fair bit of, it's cinematically kind of doctored up, but a fair bit of gameplay. And like, there's certain things in there, like there's a return of, I'm just going to say it because already in headlines, like Morgan obviously is a very key character in Dragon Age. She makes an appearance. There's things like it shows Scout Harding, who we already knew was a playable character, using magic. The fact that it's a dwarf in the Dragon Age universe using magic is intriguing in its own right. There's a baby griffin. Griffins in the Dragon Age universe are extinct, but there's one present in this game. Why is that? I forget what they call them. Alluvians? Like, there's mirror traversal to, like, kind of like the Fade or the Void. There's that has some sort of, it had a role in Inquisition. It has a role in this game. So it really truly feels like a Dragon Age game. And I'm kind of really glad that I kind of watched Adam replay Origins, because it had been too long. Like, I barely remember Inquisition, let alone Origins or two. So having watched Adam replay Origins in the last couple of months kind of reintroduced me to a lot of these concepts. Like, one of these characters is in your party, I forget which one, is a Grey Warden, which of course is like the Jedi or the Spectre of this universe, who you play as in the first game. But this is enough for me to kind of circle it on my calendar, not in terms of like, oh, it's RPG site, I kind of want to play this so I can talk about it, but just, you know, I did play the other Dragon Age games and enjoyed them. And Velgard, the more I see of it, the more I see is like the initial reveal was just really quite bad, and the game does have a little bit more promise. But of course, we're still basing this off of pre-release trailers and stuff, so it's all hopium at this point.
I'm glad you said it and not me.
Yeah.
I'm very neutral on this game. I don't know if I have like much expectations, especially after the 20-minute gameplay video. Like, for me, Dragon Age is, I've always kind of put the story in the backseat. It's like, yeah, there's interesting parts about it, but I'm always looking forward to like, well, have an interesting gameplay. And so far, it's been 1.5 out of 3, I guess. It's like one pretty, you know, the kind of old school CRPG type gameplay. Two, nah. Three, half credit, I guess, for me. So, and this one, it's like, I don't know. There were some screenshots of the Game Informer article, or I think there's even a Game Informer digital piece that's no longer up, that showcased like a skill tree in that game that looked, you know, sort of interesting. I was like, okay, hopefully there's some interesting parts about it. I don't know. I'm just kind of very whatever on it. Hopefully it's good. And if it's good, it's great. You know, well, I don't want games to be bad.
Thing that has been kind of, yeah, you got to play Dragon Age 2 so I can watch you play it and relearn all these things. But the one thing that I, and I'm not the first person to say this, but the one thing that has kind of been a weird longer term aspect of the marketing over the last couple months is when they talk about the combat or whatever. Like, first of all, like it was confirmed, I forget what the primary source of this was, is that you can only play as the main character Rook. You can't play as your party members. Which sure could be a good design decision, we don't know, but the way that they said, they're like, our system is too complex to play as your party members. And I saw someone say, and this is maybe this is phrased like a hot take, but they're like, it's building up or bolstering your game by shitting on the other games really is a tactic you could do.
I have two comments on this. First of all, I think it was PC Gamer, actually, like a fan of the original Dragon Age, he basically took like the Game Informer interviews and he basically editorialized them, because like a lot of the responses from like the dev team on this game were doing exactly as you said, where they're kind of like, well, past games in our series struggled here and here and there, but this game is better. And, you know, it kind of was like shitting on the past games and bolstering their new game. And they're saying stuff like, we're really focused on characters this time, and it's like, you weren't before. And it was very weird. And actually, Alex was like, that's basically a Final Fantasy 16 did.
It reminds me of
Final Fantasy 15 was shit. 16 is real.
Exactly. Like, I don't know. Like, I generally don't know like what benefit or that has, you know, of like our marketing tactic is to like say bad things about the older entries. You know, I actually don't know, like, what's the reasoning behind that? Or, like, in their minds, how is that, like, a net benefit?
I think it's just, like, an apology letter for the past game, but I don't think you should see it as, like, something that you should, like, just, like, shun away.
Yeah, it's just, for me, it's just, like, I don't think it's ever a good idea, to be honest. Unless somehow the previous entry or entries were, like, just, it's like if you were to, like, make a new ET game, and it's like, and you talk shit about the old ET game. Then, like,
I actually found the PC Gamer article, and I like the title of it. The title of the article is, according to BioWare, Dragon Age the Veilguard is the first entry in the series where the combat is actually fun and where the characters are intentionally the focus of the storytelling, which seems pretty unfair on the first three games. That's the title of the article.
Wait, the combat was not fun before? Is that what you're telling me?
Liked that, the combat in any of those games, apparently. I don't know. It's just, that's a very weird.
I've had, like, some people I've talked with that are kind of, there's some weird people in the Dragon Age fandom that are kind of antagonistic towards people that really preferred the first game. That kind of reads to me the same way, but in, like extending through the other two games, it's weird.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just, that's kind of the nature of, like, there'll be some people that the dislike. It's like DMC3 fans, the two kind of side-eye people who like DMC2 or DMC1 as their favorites. That's how I think of that.
Who likes DMC2 as their favorite?
I mean, look, man, some people like it. Don't ever discount the five people out there who love DMC2 as their favorite.
Oh, they should come on our podcast then.
They'll do that. But yeah, I mean, overall, just it'll depend on the final product, you know. Like, people could say whatever they want in their marketing, but at the end of the day, they have to prove themselves by making a damn fucking good game. That's kind of the start and end of it. And if you can't deliver on that, then no amount of, like,
it's been a decade since the last BioWare game that was, like, super well received, and even Inquisition had people that weren't super big fans of it. So.
Yeah, BioWare, they kind of need, like, something that at least is well regarded, because after Andromeda and Anthem, you know, they kind of need something.
And I'm willing to be an optimist, but yeah, you are kind of right, Josh. Thanks for reeling me in. Like, the trailer that they showed really doesn't take away anything for the gameplay focus of it, how linear Adam kind of described it as being. But that's the hardest stuff to judge until it's in your hands.
Exactly. So
hopefully it all pulls, like, all those different strings pull in once it's released.
I wish they would have, I remember in my preview when I basically wrote about what I saw behind closed doors, which some of that they still haven't shown. My takeaway was, I wish they just showed more about like combat and, like, mechanics, not like direct combat, but more like, you know, character building, skill systems, things like that. And there's, like, we got a couple of screenshots from Game Informer of the tree itself, but it's just kind of like, I don't know. I feel like,
and the demo, and
there's still time, the public, 2 months.
The demo that they showed was, like, super early, so it was you couldn't really draw a lot from it because it was, like, your first skill point or whatever, or super early. Like,
the funniest thing is, like, the one screenshot that people will always go to for that fucking gameplay reveal is that really messy wheel UI of you issuing other commands to your other party members because you can't play them yourselves, and it just looks bad. Like I remember, like, even, like, Japanese outlets reporting on this release date. That's the screenshot they used. It's like, oh, that's such a bad look, you know.
It looks like Mass Effect. Many people made that comparison. Like, this looks like Dragon Age by way of Mass Effect.
And it's not like you know, having other playable party members with distinct movesets is, like, a complex thing. Granblue Relink is right there with how many playable characters that all had very, very distinct, unique movesets. So people found their, like, 2 to 3 characters that they liked. And it's like, yeah, I'm having a lot of fun.
Throw that screenshot in chat or link to it. Like, I'm trying to, like, the way you describe it, I have to see this.
Oh, I'm
looking at
our
old news post. I'm sorry.
I can get it.
Yeah, Adam knows which one I'm talking about. Me, I'm just like, oh man, I have to go to Google or some shit. Or
I think I remember the only thing is like it looks very purple to me. It's like that. I don't know, for some reason.
Well, that's kind of the vibe they're going for with their marketing, which is what it is.
Yeah. So hey, at least you know, you have something to do when you're not out there trick or treating. Thank you, Adam. He posted that screenshot that I was referring to in our voice chat. Yeah.
No, I wasn't going crazy. It does look very purple.
It looks awful. God.
It's like Xenoblade 2, only somehow worse.
Only somehow worse.
Xenoblade 3 is an improvement or no?
To an outside person not playing it themselves, it looks like a fucking mess. It looks like an incomprehensible mess.
Xenoblade 2, like, if you don't have context, looks terrible also. When you play, like, I get it. Like, once you understand what everything is conveying, does that make it all of a sudden good or is it still bad? Anyways, I'm reminded of Xenoblade 2 when I see Dragon Age Veilguard's UI.
In the Mass Effect games, when you pull up like your wheel to like issue a command, at a glance it might be kind of messy, but you're usually pretty quick. Like you pull up the wheel, you move your stick in like one direction to like issue a command, and then you close it. And this is like within a half a second. You know, when you're like you're not in that menu for very long. It's just like you pull it up just to do a quick action, and then you put it away. So maybe it's the same here.
Okay, I pulled up an old Xenoblade 2 screenshot. I'm like, okay, actually Xenoblade 2 might be worse.
Well, Xenoblade 2, at least it's on like the border of the screen there versus Dragon Age.
That's true. It's not in the center. You can see in the center of the screen what you're looking at.
That's ever gonna have a fucking RPG video series of just ranking UIs.
There we go. Yep. So October 31st, Dragon Age Veilguard. We'll cover it here at RPG 7. We have a couple more. This one actually is an announcement trailer. This one is a game that I was actually talking about a little bit before we started recording. Back in 2021, there was a release of a first-person kind of open-world RPG called Chernobylite. Post-apocalyptic. We didn't really cover it in detail on our site. We just didn't have the bandwidth to. But I was looking at some gameplay of it and then saw the announcement trailer for Chernobylite 2 Exclusion Zone from the Farm 51, self-published, slated to release in 2025. There is a new announcement trailer for this game. It's a little over a minute long, but it's mostly third-person like environmental shots with like a panning camera. And it looks interesting enough. There's not a lot of detail here. There's no voiceover. We just kind of have the vibe of the trailer and the press release talking about character development, combat, the open world exploration. But the interesting thing is, I was trying to answer the question before the podcast so I could speak to it to some extent, is that I can't tell if Chernobylite 2 Exclusion Zone is played in first person or not. Like a lot of the gameplay is shown as like a third person shooter aspect to it. But Chernobylite 1, as far as I can tell, was entirely first person. So I guess anyone here played either. I guess not either. Has anyone here played Chernobylite?
I didn't play it. I watched a fair bit of gameplay, like of some streams when there was like around release. And for me, it looked like, you know, that first person style, it leaned more first person survival, almost like a stalker in a sense. So like when I was looking at the trailers, like they definitely have the new perspective, a third person perspective. I don't know if it's the only perspective, because after the logo in the video, you see a shot of a first person perspective pulling up like an item, like a radar of some sort, in the announcement trailer. So I was like, can you toggle between first person and third person? But they wouldn't make that clear in any of the descriptions, but they really were pushing this third person perspective.
At the minute mark of the trailer, yeah, there's like a few seconds where he's got like his iPad and first person. Okay.
And it's kind of weird because like the tone and the cadence that they gave they're pitching this, like it feels like it's less survival and more like almost like a leaning more arcade-esque looter shooter, in the way that like it feels like combat is more like aggressive and visceral and less like survival and the survival as deliberate style. And they really mentioned it, like I remember the first Chernobylite have some sort of base building or like building out a base, but I didn't know how involved it was. But like, it really puts it front and center in this game with the way they describe it, where, you know, you are managing a base, and like you'll recruit people into the base and allocate them different activities to upgrade your weapons, get like special items. And then like you also have like builds in this game, where like you can have like a sniper build and like a melee build. You can switch them on the fly because you're a planeswalker and you have the power to like just switch out different builds on the fly in this game. I was like, I don't think the first game had that sort of like emphasis on like builds or RPG leaning games. To me, it was like more survival-esque in my head, but I could be wrong too. For me, it feels like this feels like a tone shift and something that like they're more just trying out, like more of an experimental type of sequel, which is cool, you know. I do like that more than like survival game, but I don't know, like, you know, it's kind of wild, but it looks pretty, yeah, you know.
And yeah, Chernobylite seems to have a pretty strong like cult following. A good number of reviews on Steam, very positive, and yeah, Reddit seems like it's pretty active. A lot of excitement over the sequel. So yeah, we it's kind of been something that hasn't been like in our focus on the site, but it looks like it's been pretty well received. And the first game looks like it's something that would be up my alley. But it's just the usual bugbear of finding time to play it.
Yeah, and also Stalker 2 is around the corner too. And I can't wait for Stalker.
But yeah, so yeah, the Chernobylite 2 Exclusion Zone. You have an announcement trailer for it, being launched in 2025 for PC, Xbox, and PlayStation. We got the trailer and the screenshots up on the site. Here's another one that I think was announced earlier this year. I'm not sure.
Like April last year, I believe, is when it was first shown off. But I guess I just didn't cover it because like this one seems to have like fallen under radars, and also like it just wasn't really clear what type of game it was until now.
Well, anyway, I'll let you just take it away on this one. Okay. No worries. You're the one that covered the trailer and the announcement for this.
Yeah. So like I just kind of saw it on my YouTube feed. I was like, oh, I we didn't get anything like on this. So I was like, this seems interesting. So this is Neo Berlin 2087 by developer Elysium Game Studio. They're also going to be publishing this. They describe it as like a detective thriller action RPG, and it seems to be like almost like an indie spiritual successor to Deus Ex. It's a very sci-fi like cyberpunk-esque setting. I forgot the actor of the Deus Ex dude from Human Revolution. I forgot his name.
Elias Tufexis.
Yeah, he sounds like he might be also playing the main characters, but I'm not 100% sure. So that's why I left that out. But a lot of people are seem to be thinking that he's also in this game. You play as a detective named Nolan, and the start of Neo Berlin. It starts off with like the head of a police department getting murdered, and your task is finding and safeguarding his daughter because she might have some critical info that unveils the truth of her father's murder. And you know, you kind of, as you're playing throughout this game, you uncover this conspiracy, and you have like state of the art tech at your disposal. Like you have like I guess say augmented eyes, but I don't know if they refer to it as augmentations and how this relates to gameplay. But you definitely have some parts of your body that, like, you know, are sort of like Deus Ex augmentations. Also, like, you know, you have the detective tools as well to, you know, crack the case. You can fairly switch between first person and third person perspective on, like, when you're doing combat. So there's a lot of scenes throughout the gameplay trailer that shows, you know, first person and third person perspectives, swapping on the fly. And like it kind of looks really, really cool. Like it has a really slick aesthetic for its sci-fi premise. If anything, the only thing that's like seems sort of janky and off-putting is like it has that uncanny valley in its facial animations when people are talking to each other. It's definitely reminiscent of like when I forgot the name of the tech demo showcase that Sony had for Heavy Rain, but it reminded me of that. But it looks really, really slick. I definitely am interested in checking out, you know, when this game is coming out, and definitely do plan on playing it because, you know, I love Deus Ex, and anything that sort of resembles it, I'm down for it. And like anyone who has like a different interpretation or has their own different angle on it. So
I'm reading some of the YouTube comments for the trailer, and there's some people excited, some people that say it looks really rough and needs just more time to cook, though they like the idea. My old friend, 90s video game Vinyl Trenchcoat returns.
Hell yeah.
The protagonist looks like he was stung by a bee in the face and is having an allergic reaction.
Like I said, it's not really the prettiest, production values, but in terms of, just an independent game studio kind of trying to do their own thing, it's like, yeah, for sure. Hopefully, they didn't put a release year on it, but they did say it's coming to PS5, Xbox Series, and PC. So, we'll see what the final product looks like. This looks, pretty cool. They have a pretty strong first impression.
So that will go into updates and new trailers for games we've previously covered on the site. We have, of course, coming in early September, in less than a month, we have the big episode, new version of Persona 3 The Answer for the Reload version of that game. We got a new trailer for it, and from what I can see from people that have been watching this excited for this, season pass content 3, whatever they're marketing it as, is the music for The Answer for episode Igus. I know a lot of people have been trying to pull that out of the trailer.
Yeah, hardcore Cry. That's why everyone's probably waiting.
There's been a lot of positive reception on the new battle theme Don't that's premiered in this trailer. Obviously, Heartful Cry is one of the best themes out of Persona 3, so that having a return here, good. So,
and they talk about how this relates to the base game, like how your Persona compendium goes over. You can do it on most of the time unless you pick the Heartless difficulty. They talk about the soundtrack, a whole bunch of new screenshots about, obviously playing as Igus in the protagonist role.
Yeah,
I don't know. Seems like kind of what we expected for it. We thought we were pretty sure that it was going to come as DLC, and then it was like, surprise, it's coming as DLC. And then there's nothing really surprising about that. It's not saying it's bad. It's like, oh, yeah, that's
the answer. Can I vent about another outlet very minorly?
Let's go. I'm always down.
So yes, I only saw someone tweet about it. I didn't read it myself, but the Eurogamer put a preview up for this. Eurogamer. And they were like, they said something like, they're not sure they want to play as Igus because she's a cold-hearted robot and the least relatable character of the cast.
Cool.
And I'm just like,
are you sure this person played the original?
Like, Igus is like the deuterogonist of the game. Like, she's practically is the second main character. Like,
he's more human than some of the characters.
That's
the
whole point of the character. Yeah. Exactly.
They don't need to have played the answer before to get a solid preview piece. But it's kind of a weird phrase.
Cold-hearted robot is not how I describe Igus.
People dislike this game not for Agus. They dislike this game for the gameplay on the ruthless difficulty back in the day.
That's kind of a really funny angle.
I feel like that's almost like a misreading of the character to me. Anyway,
that's awesome. That's really funny. Oh man, I didn't know about that. Thank you. That's hilarious. That's really good. But yeah, I mean, but this will have different multiple difficulty levels. Obviously from all the way from peaceful to heartless. And then there's easy, normal, and hard. So, I mean, if people are struggling and difficulty is the problem, they can breeze through this game.
They didn't describe Igus as cold-hearted robot. It was cold and human and the robot and the least relatable character. Sorry, I just wanted to be accurate. But
least
still,
relatable too? What?
Like, inhuman robot is kind of like, that's the whole point of the character. She's a robot, but she becomes human.
That's one of those things, I don't know if this person, played Persona 3 or not, or if they finished it, because I can understand if you only played a bit of Persona 3, only got to Igus's introduction and stopped. I guess
it's the very ending of the game is the most human fucking moment with her.
That's crazy.
You definitely know who didn't finish the game.
Well, people have opinions, so. We don't have a hive mind.
You can have bad ones.
I love it.
Yes, that is. I'm with Chow. Okay.
So I mean, I'm interested to see. There's definitely some moments in the trailer. It's like, okay, they're kind of playing in trade with some developments. That's interesting. So, I dig it. Okay. But like I said, I think me and Adam agree that like the answer is like it's less about the story and more about, you know, the gameplay twist that it adds to it, where it's a more challenging.
Well, I'm glad that they have like the Heartless difficulty is like if you want like something that's like the original kick, right? It's just like when you play the regular Reload, it's like the game is super easy compared to the original. It's like,
oh yeah, since you're able to transfer theurgies as well to Aegis from the protagonist, it's like, oh god, it's like it for me. It's just like it's no matter what difficulty, aside from, I guess from the hardest one, it's like it's gonna be super super simple because theurgies like trivialize a lot of.
I mean, Reload. Persona more and more giving more and more conveniences to the player. It's nothing new.
Yeah, like it's kind of funny because personal anecdote, but like I have some acquaintances that are like they played Persona 3 Reload and then took a break and played Vengeance, and they're like, oh man, it's hard to get back into Reload after playing SMT5 Vengeance, you know, because they enjoyed like the difficulty ramp in it. When you go back from Vengeance to Reload, it's like Reload's kind of a cakewalk. It kind of is being generous to it. So I get it, where they're coming from.
We also got a new trailer for a game coming out at the end of the month that we all kind of have circled on our calendar, which is Visions of Mana. So this is what they call the tourism guide. It's basically an environment-focused trailer. So we've had trailers talking about the characters and the different elemental classes that they can unlock through those. This one is just called Tourism Guide, and it's not that long. It's 90 seconds, just showcasing jungles, a big Elysium-type tree, a farm, a snowy area, some enemies. It's cute. I don't know if there's a lot to really latch onto here.
This is out? I was like, is it this upcoming or next one? I was like, oh, it's
a week from next Friday.
So, this because it's gonna be a shame. Like I won't be able to like touch this game for several days because it comes out the day before PAX West starts, or like 2 days before, and yeah, I'm gonna be like super busy with that first before this. But I do want to get around to it.
I haven't played the demo yet, but I don't know. Like RPG demos are hard. I'm not saying that means they're accurate or not accurate inherently. They're just hard.
I wonder what they did to that though, because like I have like a 4 to 5 gigabyte update for that.
Yeah, demo they updated up on the Steam. Demo.
Why would they update demo that?
I have no idea what they updated though. Did they fix like a lot of like my issues with it, because it has like really, like it has the stuttering issue. I don't know if they fixed that. Cutscenes ran at 30 FPS.
I think that's still a thing. I think
that's not great. That's like the one thing I wish they fixed. I don't like the frame rate cap on cutscenes.
I don't mind if I'm playing like a remaster game that's now in 60 frames per second, and like, oh, the cutscenes are still in 30 because they were rendered years ago or whatever. But like for a new game, come on.
Yeah. We're being nitpicky. I get it. Come on. Everyone else is doing it. All the other cool RPGs are already standardizing this.
Not near. Was it the Nier Automata that didn't do that either?
I mean, that was so long ago.
Well, they eventually updated Nier.
Yeah, but yeah. They didn't fix the cutscenes, did they?
Oh, I don't know. I just know they like took them like 3 years, it felt like, to like update that PC.
You can wait 3 years for a patch for this.
Great. Awesome. Just what I'd love to hear.
Here's another one that I probably could have covered alongside with Chernobylite and Neo Berlin 2087. Because it was a game that first got announced in 2023. It went dormant for a while. It showed back up at the Future Game Show. This is a terrible title for the game, but this is the title. The game is The Relic First Guardian. It's not me if you've heard this before, but it's a Souls-like.
Last Guardian.
No, the first.
That already came out. We're getting the prologue, sorry.
What about the first soldier? The Last Soldier.
But anyways,
whenever we cover all these different AA Souls-likes, I feel like I have to at least describe it in audio format like this to try to differentiate all of them, because there are so many. In this one, you play as an assassin character, and your main two weapons are like a dagger, but also a staff. So you're like an assassin mage. So there, that's me trying to boil it down to like a single sentence to try to say like, how is this one different? So we have a pretty fun, like 2 minute gameplay trailer. It's again, it's gameplay without any UI, which I love to see the UI, but I get why they don't add it. But showcasing a lot of the, like the sword abilities, a lot of the long range magic abilities. We have a lot of screenshots here in our little gallery, but the color grading for this game is a little bit like muted by design. So at a distance, all the screenshots kind of look identical.
My favorite part about like all the footage they released and the screenshots and the videos, like they always have their logo front and like in each of them, like just below centered is their logo. So I'm just like thinking it's like maybe that should just be in the full game. Their logo, it always says the Relic First Guardian, no matter where you are in this game.
Yeah, but this is being developed by Project Cloud Games. It's based. It tries to draw inspiration from Korean folklore. It's listed for just like Berlin 2087, or not Berlin 2087, just like Chernobylite. It's slated for PC, PlayStation, and Xbox in 2025. So it's something to keep an eye on. But the trailer is just it gets lost in the soup. We're focusing on it because we have as a headline in our podcast. But other than that, I don't know that it does a good job drawing attention to it. That's kind of my take.
I'd like to give like other upcoming Souls like Cinders and Notria. That'll be coming.
Yeah, soon. I mean that Deathbound just came out. I don't know how that one was received. And then there's of course Kazan we talked about last week.
Oh yeah, that's right. We love Souls likes.
There's so many of them.
There's so many.
I have a quick correction to make.
Oop.
The Nier Automata port up patch came 4 years after it released, not 3.
Awesome.
Oh, okay.
We love
well, because it got its Epic Store version, which was like a different porting house. Then the Steam version got updated.
No, it wasn't Epic. It was like Xbox.
PC. Oh, that's right. Yeah, it was Microsoft Store. That's right. Yeah, that was a weird time. But apparently the Switch port's pretty good. I put it on Switch.
According to Cullen.
All right, so here's the thing that we kind of teed up earlier. I guess once we teed it up earlier, we could have moved it up. We're going to talk again about Owlcat, but we're not going to talk about Owlcat Games. We're going to talk about them as a publishing house. So indie game or independent game publishing has been kind of a, I don't know about a hot topic, but a volatile topic in the last couple of years because the amount of corporate consolidation we've seen, a lot of studios, you know, laying off numbers of developers, small and big. So Owlcat has stepped into the ring. And
on that note, just real quick, sorry, like 2 weeks ago, or maybe within a month or so, like Humble Games, not Humble Bundle, but the publishing Humble Games just closed everything. So
and right. Ubisoft just announced that they let go of a team that was supposedly working on something that was The Division related. Like it just never ending. It all kind of gets lost. You almost get numb to it. So hopefully in good news, we have Owlcat acting as a publisher for two independent projects that they've announced this week. They are two RPGs, Rue Valley and Shadow of the Road. Rue Valley, we've gotten a announcement trailer for. This is a narrative RPG clearly inspired by Disco Elysium. So we've also had a few games that were in that vein. But this is another one where it's got the similar sort of art style and the similar sort of like perspective and color and art to it.
And to be clear, they pretty much explicitly say we took inspiration from Disco Elysium.
Yeah. So, which, hey, you know, that's a good one to take inspiration from. But basically, it has something to do with a time loop where in each loop, you can craft your personality in different ways, which I think is a kind of a fun idea. You can store memories from each loop in order to like inspire you or elucidate you for future loops. And it's got a fun little 2D parallax art style for it. And it's, and again, like not really focused on combat. We have a lot of like comic book style art to it. It's got kind of that Disco Elysium kind of deliberately low frame rate, kind of like the Spider-Verse movies where it's meant to animate in like that 24 color timing, not color timing, frame timing, frame pacing.
Yeah.
And even its UI elements very clearly are inspired by Disco Elysium. So it's announced for PC. It's got a Steam page, no release date. So it looks like this is being announced pretty early, but yeah, with the first of, Owlcat's, publishing efforts. The second one, I don't believe we have a trailer for yet, but it is called Shadow of the Road. This is a turn-based strategy RPG set in a historic feudal Japan with both yokai and steampunk machinery. So to me, I'm like, oh, so like Neo. I guess Neo didn't have any steampunk. It's like Neo cross Wasteland 3. It even got like a Robo Scorpion on it. So we got a few screenshots for this one. I don't know if there's a trailer or footage.
It's not really a proper trailer because, like, yeah, nothing recent because they had a gameplay teaser, but that was 4 years ago.
That's what I was wondering, like, from the developers before they got picked up a publisher.
Yeah, they have
PAX East 2020. You can find some gameplay.
Yeah, their YouTube, even, like, I linked their YouTube, and, like, within the past months, the only thing that they've released is, like, sort of, like, less than 30-second, like, just very basic gameplay clips of just them prototyping different systems of the game. It's very, very early prototype type of stuff that they're messing with. So they've been at it for several years, but they finally have like at least some form of like financial backing, thanks to Owlcat Games to just continually, you know, get to finally start, you know, making real headway into their game. So
it's like, kind of fun. Like I'm watching this PAX East footage from 4 years ago, and it's kind of an interesting little mashup. There is a character who is like throwing spears at a mecha scorpion, and then I forget the name of the mythical creature is, where you have a humanoid woman top and a spider legs bottom, Quilag from Dark Souls. I don't know. I forget the name of that creature, the half human, half spider. But someone just transforms into one of those because it's, you know, that's the yokai aspect. So it's feudal Japan, yokai, and mech scorpions. So like, yeah. Okay.
That's always cool seeing like a strategy RPG.
I think it's Japan. Just Arachne. Like,
oh, okay. Like it's always cool seeing like a feudal Japan setting with a like strategy RPG because like you have stuff like Shadow Tactics, for example, really, really great one. Who tried that and like it got a lot of support for that. So it's like congratulations to, like the developers of Rue Valley and Shadow of the Road because like they were the two like Owlcat reviewed more than 50 projects and these are the two that they decided to like sign on. You know, it's rough, it's hard. Trying to like, you know, find a publisher these days in the gaming space. So it's difficult, but like, you know, it's those that are able to make the cut, you know, I'm sure they're mega grateful to Owlcat for that.
Yeah, and no release date for either of these, but of course,
it reminds me it reminds me, like, not just Owlcat, but, like, the recent initiatives, like, remember the Among Us developers, like, from their newfound success, they became, a publishing arm now, as well.
And not quite related, but what was the name of the studio? We didn't talk about this, because it's not explicitly RPG-related, but Tango Gameworks got picked up by...
Oh, yeah, by Krafton. Yes.
And they not only that, but they rehired everyone that was laid off. Like that
Not everyone. It's like 50 out of 100, I believe.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. Well, I won't say makes sense, because I don't know like the logistics of
it. Yeah, I don't know, like, because it gets kind of murky, because like, were the other 50 like more the Microsoft side of things? Like, it's hard to tell, like, you know, but at least we know like 50 out of the 100 that worked on the out there are like getting transferred over. That's the word they use, like getting transferred over. Because I don't know if the other 50 are like more the Microsoft side of things or not in that deal. But at the very least, you know, it's kind of nice to see that like, hey, Tango as a developer gets to live on thanks to whatever arrangements that Microsoft and Krafton did behind the scenes, and I believe they're already working on like the sequel to Hi-Fi Rush.
Yeah, it's kind of odd because they said explicitly, I don't know if they said sequel, but they said like the Hi-Fi Rush IP, like they're it's Hi-Fi Rush related.
I don't know if the Evil Within IP got the carry over. For all I know, I think it's only Hi-Fi Rush IP got the carry over, and I don't know if any other past Tango Gameworks IP were able to transfer as part of the agreement. But at the very least, you know, Hi-Fi Rush fans do at least have something to look forward to in that aspect. Hopefully, you know, the Krafton will treat them right. That's kind of the big hope, right? So at least good on Krafton for picking them up, and hopefully, you know, gets to treat them right, gets to let them, you know, get the trust in their direction. Yeah.
It's always good to be able to share good news, like, from a business standpoint, rather than layoffs and closures. It's a good change of pace. Yeah. You should keep that momentum.
Yeah. So hopefully, you know, just more and more people enter the publishing space and help out, you know, just development are, you know, recognizing the game industry has continually been getting fucked over, for lack of a better word for it. Yeah. Good on Alcott Games, good on Krafton, and good on, you know, the Among Us developers and all the other people who have started, like, entering the publishing space on, you know, obviously expanding their profiles in the game industry space, but as well as just, you know, just helping out just very, very talented development teams with their ongoing projects.
And then the last game that has an update, no trailer for this one, just a news, a press release, newsletter, whatever you want to call it. This is for Phantom Brave, The Lost Hero. This is the Phantom Brave title that was announced earlier this summer during the Nintendo Direct. And then, James, I believe you played this one at
Anime Expo. Yep.
Yeah. So basically, Nippon Ichi and NIS America just gave the old school sort of newsletter that talks about how the battle system works, how it's a strategy RPG with free movement, how you can transform, objects on the map, like trees and rocks, into ally units. Talks about the bond system, how that interfaces with combat, character creation, post game challenges. So it seems like it's kind of like, I don't know, it's a good overview for the game, but I don't think it's anything surprising in terms of what they showed with the initial trailer from the Nintendo Direct or with your preview from Anime Expo. But it includes a couple more screenshots of what the game looks like, the UI, the characters, and things like that.
Yep.
On different maps, you have different gadgets like cannons, catapults, fans, slot machines that can be used to perform a variety of actions. There, that was the one paragraph that I had centered on my page to say something of substance for Phantom Brave, The Lost Hero. So slated for release next year for all consoles, well, not all consoles, Switch, PlayStation, and PC. Going into some incremental updates and some release dates here. Here's our usual HoYoverse touch-in. Genshin Impact 5.0 launching at the end of the month on August 28th. Tell me if you heard this before, but it introduces a new region and new characters. Sorry, that sounds really.
You can also transform into dinosaurs.
It's how many Genshin updates have been like introduces this area and these characters.
You can transform into dinosaurs.
I did not watch a trailer at all, but someone gave me a summary that this is basically the greatest Genshin patch ever. 4 years of quality of life is finally being fixed and added to this patch.
Give us one highlight about why they would say that. What is being added in this patch that's taken 4 years?
Okay, so you get like a free 5-star selector, like when you come into this patch when the new region drops. So you could
they bribe you to like this patch.
You get bribed. Okay, that's one. So the weapon banner has also been changed. Now it's just 50-50. Or not like 50-50. It's like, you know when you lose the 50-50? You add like a point, and you need 2 points to get the weapon you want. Now it's dropped down to 1 point. So it's half as awful. So
that's still pretty awful, though.
It's still pretty awful, but it's half as awful.
Like, their direct competitor right now is Wuthering Waves, and their fucking 5-star banner.
Weapon is 100%.
Yeah, it's 100%. You just always, like, if you hit a 5-star on that weapon banner, you see gold, you know you're getting that weapon. It's like, there's no guesswork.
So it's like, okay, it's better, but, you know, it's still awful, right?
So great. Awesome.
But it's like, it added a lot of improvements that people were complaining for the last, like, 4 years. It's like, it's finally being implemented in this patch. It's like, it's finally here, you know? So I'm guessing it's because of Wuthering Waves. I know some people disagree. It's like, oh, Genshin has no competition. They're always number one in, like, money. You know, it's like, but you know what? I feel like if there is no competition, they wouldn't make any of these changes. It's like, why would it take 4 years? They know it was a problem since day one.
You know? Awesome. Great. I'm looking at this list right now of quality of life rewards. I guess people... There's actually, I don't know, is Kachina a 5-star? Because they're saying free Kachina. And I don't know.
I don't know. I didn't pay attention to the character in this patch. So I believe that's a 4-star. They would never give you a limited 5-star. That would be hell freezing over.
Yeah, meanwhile, Mother Maze is getting you a free 5-star character. That's one of the new characters in their patch. Great. Awesome. Free 5-star standard character every anniversary. What does that mean?
Their anniversary awards has always been lackluster in the past 4 years. So this time, it's like, if there is an anniversary, you get a selector ticket to pick a 5-star, which is non-limited. So, Okay, it's like, so finally the anniversary award did something.
So, usually the anniversary... But the thing about every anniversary, so like, because this quality of life list or whatever summary I'm reading says free five star standard character, because that means that makes sense every anniversary. What does that mean? It's like for every anniversary from here on out, or are they doing it retroactively? What does that mean?
I think it's from here on out. I'm not gonna do it like retroactively. Come on.
Okay, great, awesome. So,
but you know, it's like most of the whales are probably, it's like, it's just like whatever at this point, because they have everything. It's like, it's a little bit late, you know, but
a little bit late.
It's something, I guess, right? Then there is one item that lets you, like, you know, one of the hardest thing about playing these games is trying to find the perfect artifact, or that would be like your echoes in Riverine Waves. You know, like trying to find the perfect artifact is hard. So they added an item that lets you, like, craft an item where you get to pick the main stat, and I think it was two extra substat, and two of them will be random. So it's like it solved all your gearing issues, because there's one time I think I spent more energy trying to get the perfect relic or artifact, and it's just like, it's never here. And you're like, maybe I should have just wasted those gems on more rolls. But, you know, it's like you're stuck with this RNG problem, right? So they added an item that, you know, Honkai Star Rail had, where you could kind of forward to main stat, but it's even better than the Honkai Star Rail version, so, because you could pick two substats to it, technically, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I'm thinking of Wuthering, and like main stats for their echoes is never the problem, because you can hit main stat just fine, pretty much in it. It's not the most awful thing to do. But the substats for their echoes, there's some data mines that say there might be a way to reroll substats in it, and that'll be a fucking lifesaver. But that remains to be seen.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see other things on this list I'm looking at. That land chest, which is the new region or whatever, gives more primo gems.
Primo gems always. I don't think this is huge, but it's something, right? Like I think in most patches there's three types of chests, right? There's a common chest which will give you 5, and there's like a rare chest that will give you 10, and there's like the luxurious chest that will give you like 30, like primo gems. I guess they kind of like double the reward from it, so I guess it's huge. I guess if you like to explore, right? I think the other thing is like the stamina. You know how like you had to find these these geoculus or something, I forgot their name, it's like an element and it's like a coolus or something. It's like these floating like kind of like crystal cores or something, and you grab it, you give it to a statue, your character has permanently more stamina, right? And that's only in the first two regions, right? After the first two regions, none of the like the new regions give you more stamina. So I guess in this next patch, they kind of expand your stamina. So you probably won't be able to like run out of stamina while climbing with the huge amount of stamina you might get in the new patch. So
it feels like shitty now. It felt bad already in Breath of the Wild, but like it feels like it's just like Genshin kind of like doubled down on it. It just meanwhile Wuthering Waves like kind of like stamina is like a super non-issue in.
Stamina is more like, it's more like for combat, really. It's like, oh, you want to like, you know, do like sidestep or those dash charge or whatever. It's like, then you lose like kind of like a bar to it. But like when it comes to traveling, you don't lose like hardly any. So it's like going back to Genshin, awful to travel around.
Increasing stamina and Wuthering is like a non-issue, because like you want to do it, like you naturally do it because you're trying to do like fill out your data bank. For echoes and stuff like that, you naturally want to level up your data bank to like make to have 100% 5-star or 100% rates on getting like the best like rarity in those Wuthering, and so like that like stamina increasing just comes naturally because you want to upgrade data bank and that. So it's just like kind of like weird, like trying to like mentally compare Wuthering Waves and Genshin. Because I'm just like thinking of like, man, it just feels so much better when Wuthering how they handle this shit.
I'm just seeing this like patch is like, oh, it's like we're better than our competition now. It's just like it's a little bit too late. It's like you just came in 4 years.
It's like one of those like we're better than our competition that's like barely like it's been 2 to 3 months out from their launch, and meanwhile we're giving all this quality of life 4 to 5 years.
Like
awesome.
So yeah, they're not doing this from the kindness of their hearts, in my opinion. It was just like, it was like a thing just to like demean their competition and just like take them down.
By the way, I gotta say the new patch in Wuthering Waves, very fun. I do like the base building thing that they're, the festival thing that they're doing. A lot of fun too.
I think I'd watched my friend stream that. He was doing these, these like level 90 type bosses in the world. It just keeps one-shotting him or something. It's like,
the level 90 bosses are like, they're not easy, but they're not difficult either, like where I'm at. The only ones that are like hard in that game is like the hologram. Those are fun. But like there's like a new festival event in that game where you get like build out like new stalls and like, and there's like a, you can have like chibi versions of like your characters in this menu. It's actually a lot of fun. I actually dig it a lot.
I've seen the patch. It's pretty huge. I mean, it's like if they could do that like every single patch, it's just like,
yeah, if they could do, yeah, if they could somehow keep a momentum like that patch, it'd be fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's like Holyverse has some answering to do.
Like, and the new characters are like a lot of fun. Her mechanics too. She feels really.
Yeah, he got her too. He got her and some other character all in one draw, and we're like, what?
Yeah, God.
And then we're like watching him play, and he's like, I think she gets like these charges, and it's some of these like paper birds or something.
Well, basically, when she has like this, whenever she attacks, she fills up like this meter. Whenever she fills up three charges, she can plop down like two like circular nodes, and then plop down a third node by doing like her skill plus heavy attack. So you can have up to three nodes, and then she can like directly warp to them and basically pop them, and then it'll summon birds from each node and like does a shitload of damage. And but her main like utility is like she's a sub DPS. You can build her as a main DPS if you want. But like her real value is like her synergy with some characters to really make some of their skills explode. Like for example, Jinxi has like her skill that normally does like, you know, 100k like on a full charge. You can make it do like 500 to 600k because of her buffs. And it's like fucking insane.
I think the thing that he wants to show me, like, clearly when he was playing that patch is, like, when you pick a character, there's, like, these icons right next to your stat. It says, like, main DPS, sub DPS or something. It's, like, their combat roles or something. And he's, like, trying to, like, show me. He's, like, hey, look, there's Jinxi, and she only has two roles, like, main DPS and something else. And then he shows me the paintbrush girl. I forgot her name. And she has, like, six combat roles or something.
But you can make her a main DPS or sub DPS, you know. She synergizes well with a lot of characters, but she can make like the main big damage dealers hit even harder and really kind of trivialize a lot of content if you're building around. You know, which is nice, you know, because like you want your characters to hit hard and like it feels good to learn.
Man, I wish I started with this game instead of Genshin.
I told you to fucking stick with it, and you're like, nah, fuck that shit, dude. I love Genshin. And
then, it's some cost fallacy, man.
It's not even too late, Chow. You can just like hop in and have fun already.
Look,
you know?
I have all this like whaling gear. I was like, I want to transfer that shit over.
My God, dude. It feels nice just having a built account in Wuthering, dude. It's awesome. Because it like you have a lot of characters to just like have fun with.
And now I can't play both games because I feel miserable in one game, and in the other game I don't have the gear.
Well, you can always stick with it, dude. Like, you know, they're giving you a free 5-star in that game too, along with all the other shit and a returning bonus. So I don't know.
It's up to you. It's time to give up on this and just star rail.
I would never recommend it to like a normal person, but you're not a normal person, Sha. I know you have the same brain worms as me, so that's why I'm fine with giving you shit. If it feels like any normal person, like in this context,
I know you're suffering, Chow. Like,
yeah. If it's any other person, I'd be like, no, stay away from Genshin, stay away from Wuthering, stay away from fucking gacha games. They're fucking awful. But, you know, I know you can handle it, Chow.
Well, that's. I'm like, that's enough.
I feel like that's nice.
Boy over his corner. So, well, report back at the end of the month and see how your 5.0. Super quality of life update, and the three new characters are. One of them rides a dolphin, so that seems neat. Let's see, a few more release dates to go through before we wrap up. Key Locker, which is a game that we've covered a few summers in a row since it was first announced in 2020. This is a indie cyberpunk isometric strategy RPG with musical elements. That's a very long-winded description, but it's got a lot of things going on at once. We finally have a release date for this. It is going to be released on September 18th for all consoles and PC.
Yeah, hopefully they've tweaked the battle system, because like it's cool in concept, but the demo that I played, it just kind of punished you for not being able to like do timed hits both on attack and defense like constantly and perfectly. So I just felt like it just wasn't fun. Hopefully they tweaked it so it's like more forgiving, at least in either like a larger window of error and or tweaking damage and defense values around it. Because like if you're just asking people to always be 100%, 120% to just like have a functional battle system, it's not great. Hopefully
there is a demo still available. It's not one of those like limited Steam Summerfest demos. Like the demo is still up. So if you're interested, you can go try it out.
Yeah.
So continuing on for release dates as we wrap up this podcast, we have another indie RPG releasing on Steam before the end of September. On September 24th, we're going to get Dark Sky. This is a deck-building RPG. I don't actually know much about it. We haven't covered it on our website before, but Josh saw it and covered the release date announcement earlier this week. So it's got a like turn-based battle system, but it's like you have your party on the left, the enemies on the right, but you have your deck at the bottom that determines which actions you can perform. So I'm sure there's a better point of comparison for what this game plays like, but I haven't played a lot of these, so I don't actually have that on hand. But releasing at the end of the month on PC.
Yeah, looks a little bit like Slay the Spire S in terms of UI, and then like in battle, there's actually like places you can move to in combat, so there's actually like circular like places you can actually like position your characters at. You know, which will obviously affect like, you know, their attack ranges and what probably like the effective ranges for some AoE skills, I imagine too. So it looks pretty neat. Like I kind of dig the character designs. Like one of them is like kind of looks like a space marine, but like with a fish inside the helmet. So I think I'll be checking it out PAX West as well. It's definitely one that caught my eye. It's like it's neat.
A game that we played, that we covered a few years ago that I haven't played, that it kind of reminds me of is Griftlands.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In October, we have, this one's kind of fun, we have a first-person RPG called Within the Cosmos coming out on October 4th for PC. This is a, as far as I understand, a single developer, and it's designed in the style of, like, Outer Worlds. It's got the same kind of like super chromatic aberration, really like retro future aesthetic to it. So I don't know much about this, but this was a good find by Adam, because he covered it, and like the guy's been kind of tweeting about it on his personal Twitter account for a while. It doesn't have a huge following, but the game looks pretty promising. Again, Within the Cosmos launching on PC.
I actually remember seeing this game like 3 years ago and being like kind of making a mental note like, oh, I'll keep an eye on this. And then we got a random email about it again. Like, oh, yeah, it's that game. I remember seeing this. Finally, you know, getting released. You know, this developer said he's been working on it for practically a decade. So it looks pretty good, like, for a single person. Like,
yeah, I know. It's really impressive.
His Twitter account has 300 followers. Like, this is a Pico project, and that's not a judgment. That's just like, this could be a real true diamond in the rough.
It's one like, of those things that like, it's like at the, like these developers like need exposure at the end of the day. Like, you know, they just need to find like, you know, like it's hard to promote yourself, especially like it can feel nerve wracking, especially as a solo developer. And you're just kind of like hoping like, man, I hope I get like help with like just promoting, just getting this in front of eyes, you know? And, you know, we're always on the side of like, hey, you know, if you have an RPG and you're like, especially indie RPG, like, and you just need eyes on it, we're more than happy, you know, to just help get eyes on it.
He says his biggest inspirations are like Star Trek in terms of like the type of story he wants to tell, and then like Deus Ex, the original.
Hell yeah.
Also Fallout. I assume
does
I
have a
to Fallout. Yeah,
does that have
he, does, he does not say Outer Worlds, even though it kind of visually looks like Outer Worlds.
Needs a swimming stat.
It really does look like Outer Worlds visually. So I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It just gives the same vibe. But yeah, Within the Cosmos, really neat project coming out. Be playable soon. And then here's a kind of a bigger one. It was originally slated for this fall, but we have a new release date for Kingdom Come Deliverance. Well, I won't say new release date, but we have a first official release date for Kingdom Come Deliverance 2. It will launch on February 11th of next year. So starting to pack up that Q1 2025.
February already has two games in it. Because Avowed is the week after.
Not to mention, like, knowing Capcom, any of those first 3 months of the year is going to be when Monster Hunter Wild comes out. We're probably going to have a release date this time next week.
Maybe. Oh, man.
It's a Gamescom, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So early January, that's what I've got crossing my fingers on. It's not likely, but I'm always hopeful for early January because it's always empty.
And then Warhorse, they announced this with a video on their Twitter account. And basically they say, yes, the release date's not till next February, but of course they're planning to be at Gamescom to show 20 minutes of gameplay. And it's kind of a good segue for kind of our sign off. Like, obviously we've got Gamescom coming up this week. So we'll have lots of, like, I don't know if Alex is planning to attend in person. Do you know?
He is. And then of course he's splitting his time between RPG Site and VG247. So
yeah, yeah, and like regardless of whether or not he attends, like obviously whatever comes out of that we will cover here. Other studios will, you know, have their own kind of events in parallel, kind of like the way the summer events work, and then go straight on into PAX after that. And, you know, no slowing down from this point, kind of a bookend for what we said at the start of the podcast. So we'll see more Kingdom Come Deliverance. We'll probably see a little bit more Dragon Age. We'll probably have some surprise announcements, you know, a release date for Monster Hunter Wild.
I want to dismiss PAX West or just like only like small indie stuff. Like they're showing, like, I can't talk about it much, but there's a lot of like big high profile games they're showing off at PAX West.
I didn't, if I implied that it was only indie, that wasn't my intention. Cause I remember being at PAX West like 2015, I think, and they had Final Fantasy 15 was about to come out, and like they had Cindy running around in like a cosplayer, like with like one of like the vehicle, the truck that she has, like driving across the streets of Seattle. It was kind of fun, but yeah, like it's cool to see both developers, big and small, going to these events kind of spread throughout LA during the summer time frame.
And yeah, I've been seeing the emails that Josh has been getting for PAX West, like all the appointments, and it's just like, Josh is going to come back.
Josh, how does your schedule look?
Let me go there. Let me pull up a notepad. It looks like death.
I already have my first appointment scheduled for Tokyo Game Show.
Yeah,
I'm probably going to get another one scheduled pretty soon too. So it's like, going to be a busy end of the summer, beginning of fall for, sounds like, most people at RPG Site. Like, because even like, Adam can't really talk about it, but he has something he's doing in LA next week, is it?
This week.
He's like, no comments. This week.
Well, I mean,
no comments until Tuesday. Well, it's fine. It's fine. But yeah, we have a lot going on. And then of course, I'll just shout out Scott is also contributed to the site going to the PAX West. We'll have Alex over at in Germany.
I just got back from New York, actually, that it was for something related to Metaphor. I can't say anything beyond that until the embargo is.
Intriguing.
Yeah,
so, a lot going on.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Gamescom's probably going to have quite a bit for us, so we'll see. And, of course, for people like, you know, Black Myth Wukong is coming out this week for everyone else, so, you know.
I was actually going to say, like, kind of like our what's coming out this up next week, the way we've been closing these out. Obviously, Black Myth Wukong coming out officially on the 20th. So by the time this goes live, it'll be within a few days of this podcast being published. I'm going to be a nerd and play the Guild Wars expansion, so I might have a few words on that. It's coming out the same day. And then the week after, we've got Gundam Breaker 4 and Visions of Mana. So
hopefully you guys can talk about it, because I'll be at PAX West that weekend.
I guess I'll be playing Visions of Mana, I guess.
I have that circled on my calendar, so I'm hoping to play that too.
So August 31st, I will not be on that podcast, because I'll be around doing a lot of appointments and running around and trying not to die.
All right, please don't die.
But yeah. Drink water.
Yeah.
So if you enjoy this podcast, give us a rating or a thumbs up or a like on whatever your podcast service of choice is. You can support us by going to rpgsite.net and reading the review on Black Myth Wukong. You can join our Discord, hitting the link at the top of our homepage or discord.gg/rpgsite. You can find and follow RPG Site on all the social media platforms. You should just search for RPG Site and you should be able to find us. And we'll be back next week with another episode of the TetraCast. So until you hear from us next time, stay safe and take care. And we'll talk to y'all later.